Individually dimmable, so that
was good. Yeah.
Is the trailer on the east side?
Mayor, we're live. Mayor, we're live.
Good evening. I'd like to call to order the study session, September 20th, 2016. At the end of the study session, we will be going into an executive session to discuss pending and potential litigation. If we could, I'd like to go around the table and identify ourselves for the record, please.
Jay Arnold.
Shelley Kloba.
Kurt Triplett.
Kathy Brown, Public Works Director.
Kelly Jones.
Jenny Gauss.
Toby Nixon.
Dave Asher.
Penny Sweet.
And Amy Wallen. Thank you very much. City Manager.
All right. Thank you, Madam Mayor, members of the council. So tonight we have some staff recommendations for you for surface water manual choices. And our hope is that you listen to our presentation and then tell us whether you affirm our direction or provide us with alternative direction. The goal is then to come back for final adoption later on this year. But we've finally arrived at some staff recommendations and gone through committees, and we're hoping to have a robust discussion here tonight. And then, as I said, hopefully get final direction from the council. So we welcome any questions, thoughts, and direction. And to kick you off, Jenny Gauss from our surface water engineering team.
Great, thank you. So again, tonight, we'd like to brief you on research findings since our July 5th council presentation and receive your guidance on the surface water design manual recommendation. As you know, per our city's MPDS stormwater permit, we need to adopt regulations equivalent to the ecology manual by December 31st of this year. Again, all jurisdictions are in this together. Over 80 phase two and several more phase one jurisdictions are faced with the same decision and will be adopting equivalent regulations by the end of the year. Since July 5th, we presented to the Public Works, Parks, and Human Services Committee twice, the Planning and Economic Development Committee once. We conducted further internal staff discussion and analysis, including modeling some project examples, which we'll present tonight, and tried the best we can to analyze impacts on the construction cost, both CIP and private development, and started to identify impacts on life cycle and maintenance costs. So now we're going to launch into a discussion of surface water design choices. And want to point out that the MPDS permit is a relatively narrow permit. It deals with stormwater per the Federal Clean Water Act. It is charged with saying if the city does certain things to improve the quality of stormwater, we can discharge it to waters of the state. This is a much narrower focus than overall city surface water and stormwater programs, which look at water quality. They also look at the public safety and property protection aspects of flood reduction and also the environmental and legal aspects of fish habitat protection and improvement. And that's relevant here because what is required for the MPDS permit are certain stormwater items and stormwater design elements that we're talking about tonight. The city already has certain flood protection and mitigation and conveyance system and design and protection elements. And so the first thing we want to talk about is why we have those and examples of what those are. One example is that the city requires that pipes from taking stormwater from new development be sized to contain the 25-year storm event. So you don't have water on the street during most large storm events. Another example is that the city currently requires that you look a quarter mile downstream from your project and identify any problems that are there and talk about how your project is going to impact those problems and possibly do a little bit of extra mitigation to make sure that you aren't making those problems worse. Those are things that are not required by the MPDS permit per se. They've been in city code for quite some time, and so the staff recommendation is to keep those things. And so I just wanted to get confirmation that that is something the council's interested in keeping in code. Okay. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So, So in terms of choices for implementation, in July we presented you with three choices. And with further staff analysis and discussion, we've narrowed that down to two. The ecology minimum requirements, adopting those plus doing a technical notebook is a more difficult approach because you have to do more specific adoptions into code. You have to do a lot more to prove to ecology that your package makes sense. So staff is recommending that we eliminate that as an option and provide you with two packages. One is the ecology manual and one is the King County approach. In terms of what neighboring cities are doing, it's across the board. There's a really even mix of the ecology manual and the King County package. And the choice, a lot of factors go into it, including what the city is doing now and sort of the individual aspects of the geography and the population and the density and things like that of each city go into that decision. And again, for choices, we'd like to present you with the King County package, which includes the King County Surface Water Design Manual, the King County Stormwater Pollution Prevention Manual, which talks about source control. So if you're running a restaurant, it's not washing your mats out in the so the water goes in the storm drain, that kind of thing. Cross-referencing between Kirkland codes and King County codes, and then doing a Kirkland addendum, which talks about implementation. The other option is the ecology package, which would include the 2012-2014 Stormwater Management Manual. Again, that cross-reference between Kirkland and ecology review procedures. And then, per your previous head nod, it would also need to include a technical notebook about with requirements for conveyance and flood protection. So with either manual, there's going to be significant environmental benefit because of the use of low-impact development. That's techniques that get water back into the soil, slow it down, and clean it up before it gets to our streams and rivers. There will be increased study and scrutiny of facilities near high landslide hazard areas in light of OSO, trying to prevent landslides to the degree possible. The new regulations will cost more for private development and for CIP projects. There'll be more upfront study. Review costs will increase. Maintenance and inspection needs will change. And again, that's with either of the manuals. And again, the main change in the new approach is the use of low-impact development. Pervious pavement, rain gardens, site design that favors open space that allows water to soak in, dry wells and that sort of thing. This is an example of just a very generic short plat and what it might look like under the current design manual and under either of the proposed packages. On the left, you have the small red squares are small dry wells, and then you have a detention tank, which is the black rectangle. On the right-hand side, you have the whole area shaded, which is amended soils across the entire area. You have larger dry wells, you have a detention tank, and the access roads and driveways become permeable. So that's this main change to using low-impact development as much as is feasible. And again, there's a large difference between existing requirements and either of the proposed packages. Now we're going to launch into the differences between the packages, which are small relative to that jump to either manual. And some of the technical differences that will be illustrated by examples that Kelly will talk about in a minute. First of all, the King County package requires slightly larger flow control facilities for projects on certain soil types. Overall, the King County approach is more conservative in terms of low impact development. The county has concerns that we share about the long-term viability of low impact development and its ability to help control larger storm events. And so their approach is really says, yes, we're going to do low impact development to the degree possible, but also provide flow control facilities sort of as a backup. And related to that is there, in the King County approach, there are thresholds for when flow control facilities are required. And so there are a selection of projects that we'll talk about where King County would require a flow control facility, a tank or a vault, where the ecology approach would not. And finally, there are two approaches allowable in either manual in terms of designing low-impact development. The first is to use a hydrologic model to choose a suite of facilities, model it, and say you meet a certain standard. That's one approach. The second approach is to use a pre-designed list of facilities, and you have to go down that list in a certain order and choose certain facilities. And when you look at the lists that are provided by Ecology and by King County, the Ecology list is much more restrictive in the types of facilities that are on it. And so it would result in a lot more permeable pavement, whereas the King County list is much sort of broader and a little more flexible in the types of facilities that it allows. So, okay, so now I'm going to have Kelly go through some examples.
And so these examples are going to look at those differences between the two packages. And then I just want to throw in a caveat that every design can be different, especially with LIDs. So it depends on your soil conditions, your groundwater levels, whether you choose the list approach or the modeling approach that Jenny just mentioned, what type and size of your facility will help determine what types and sizes of facilities are provided. And so looking at our first example.
Do the models, are the approaches that King County uses and the approaches that Ecology uses, treat those variations differently? Do you end up with different results as you go through different soil conditions and groundwater levels?
They both use the same models, but one model, King County gives different, they give credits for low impact development, whereas the modeling that's done in Ecology is slightly different. So the way they treat LID is different, and that's what results in the differences.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so if we look at our first example, this was a 2015 short plat, so we had actual numbers. It was an existing single lot, and it was a teardown, and it divided into a two-lot subdivision. And so in this case, because of the amount of impervious created on their site and those thresholds that Jenny had talked about, this one would require a detention vault and LID BMPs under King County manual, where under the Ecology manual, it would only require LID BMPs. And in this case, it would have been about an 8-foot diameter vault or 8-foot diameter tank, about 115 feet long, that would be required under King County's manual.
Kelly, could you speak into the microphone, please?
Yes. Sorry. Go ahead.
Before moving on that one, you guys, I'm sorry. Before moving on from that one, you had some statistics about how much of the city's development is projected to be of that scale. Mm-hmm. And so what was that result?
Oh, we have those after the...
It's our next slide.
Okay,
great. And do we have numbers about how much that would cost to build?
It would be, we assume, about a $10 per cubic foot, and so it would probably be between $40,000 to $50,000, because we're looking at about, for these types of, or these size of projects, it would be between 4,000 to 5,000 cubic feet of volume.
So, and that's $40,000 to $50,000 for
dollars.
Construction,
yes.
and then design on top of that about
$5,000.
Oh my God!
And then
but you cut it in half because you got two lots.
Nice. Is it on a hill?
Was this project?
Particular one?
No.
I don't think so.
No. And so this is a 10-lot short plat. There were two existing lots that divided into 10 lots. This would require, under the King County manual, we would require a detention vault, water quality treatment, and LID BMPs. But because of the way that you can, as Jenny mentioned, where King County uses credits versus the modeling that you can do in Ecology, it would be a smaller detention vault under Ecology, and you would still need to do water quality treatment and LID BMPs. So to summarize between the two, for the two-lot short plat, we would see a higher construction cost under King County because of that vault versus no vault. We're thinking that it would be about an equal annual maintenance cost because maintenance of the vault for a two-lot short plat would be probably every 5 to 10 years for just two lots draining to that. Whereas with the ecology manual, we're going to see a lot more permeable pavement if we use the list approach. And so the maintenance cost for, we thought that the maintenance cost between permeable pavement versus a detention system would equal out between the two. And then we would have a lower life cycle cost under King County because of that permeable pavement that ecology would require. And the life cycle cost on permeable pavement is probably every 10 to 15 years versus conventional concrete, which is about every 30 years. And then the city review time would be higher for the King County manual because it would be more of a design then. And for the 10-lot short plat, we were thinking that it would be around an equal construction cost because under King County and using that list approach, you're going to see permeable pavement is the number one option on there for any surface that is a hard, that is not a rooftop. So that means your access roads, if it's less than 400 ADT, are going to be permeable pavements. Your sidewalks are going to be permeable pavements. Your driveways are going to be permeable pavements. So, and seeing how much permeable pavement has been costing lately, that we thought that the balance between a smaller detention vault plus permeable pavement would be about the same as a large detention vault and potentially other options that you could do under King County, like rain gardens or infiltration trenches for LID.
Dave.
And what, oh, I'm sorry.
Just for my better understanding, if I take sidewalks, for example, the current standard concrete and run that through a life cycle to replacement, what is the comparison over that life cycle time period of the cost of the standard concrete and permeable pavement?
My guess, and this is only a guess because they're, you know, people are just starting to install permeable pavement sidewalks all over the place. They, you do have to, if you want to keep them permeable, you have to maintain them or they get clogged. So it is a little higher maintenance cost if you want to keep them functioning. And, you know, with freeze thaws, that kind of thing, they do break up a little easier. I have not seen, and we have researched, I have not seen an analysis that I could say for sure this is the life cycle comparison, but just intuitively they're higher maintenance and a shorter lifespan. Exactly how that stacks up, I'm not sure. The one other nuance to all this that I wanted to make clear is in the case of the detention tanks, the city would be responsible for maintaining those. And so when we talk about a higher or lower maintenance cost in terms of the tanks, that would be a responsibility that we would bear, and over time we would be the ones maintaining them. So there's an increased cost in inspection, and there would be also an increased cost in cleaning and maintaining.
Is that absolute? Is there
that is current
no
practice.
Way of making that a privately owned facility? On privately owned property?
That is a policy call, and again, cities do
it
very different ways. If they are privately maintained, you would still have to inspect them as a city and run potentially an enforcement process if people aren't taking care of them.
But that's very different than us owning them. So under our current approach, they are owned by the city.
That's correct.
That doesn't necessarily have to be the case. I'd like to find out if there are other places that it's the other approach is taken.
It's a mix, yeah.
But to have them be private, because they're a shared facility, you would be mandating a homeowners association for every one of these little short plats, right?
Exactly, yeah. So you'd have to contact potentially, you know, every owner of the plat and get them to share the cost of the maintenance.
Yeah. Can you characterize what the value, this is going to be a really tough question, what the value is of the additional flood protection from having the vaults versus like just permeable pavement? Like when you have a significant storm event, can we make the case that it's worth the extra money to have that additional protection?
Philosophically, I can. Quantitatively, it's very difficult. It comes down to sort of the belief level in low impact development, and it just hasn't been around long enough to truly know. We know that low impact development is very good at the smaller storm events. We don't have a lot of evidence that it's as good for the bigger storm events, and so that's why King County is requiring more detention in their design standards. So.
Okay. And then we also evaluated some CIP projects, both in the right-of-way and on parcel. So the last time we saw you guys in July, we had talked about school walk routes being one of our concerns as far as city projects go. And so we did a couple of evaluations of city project or city school city projects that were school walk routes. And so this is 126. It's a quarter mile sidewalk project. And they're requiring, or they have enough new sidewalk, which would be 7,000 square feet, that their tripping requirements in both, or they're required to evaluate, I'm sorry, they're required to evaluate both flow control and water quality because they have enough impervious. But facilities would not be required for these, and then we would, but we would also need to evaluate LID BMPs, and that would be in the case of both manuals.
So what would that look like?
Possibly permeable pavement or sloping the sidewalks maybe into your landscape strips and either providing infiltration trenches underneath the planter strips or maybe being able to do some rain gardens in the planter strips or doing bulb outs or and that's all if LID is feasible. In this situation, there's a lot of wetlands and streams along the area, so my guess is that there would be high groundwater. So with a couple of geotechnical tests that it would probably be deemed infeasible, but every project would need to now evaluate that to make sure that it truly is infeasible.
And are we talking about the red lines?
The red lines, the, yep.
Okay.
The red lines would be where we add sidewalk. The other one is a completed project on 6th Street. This was a half-mile sidewalk project, and the end result between the two manuals is the same, but King County requires you to evaluate flow control and water quality, but a facility wouldn't be required, and both will require LID BMPs to the maximum extent feasible. And then the last project was a parcel-based CIP project, which was 132nd Square Park, and this would be looking at artificial turf soccer field, which was about an acre. This would require detention, water quality, and LID to the maximum extent feasible for both manuals. And assuming that a 0.3 infiltration rate on this site, we would be able to meet all three of those requirements under either manual by putting 11 inches of gravel storage beneath the field. And so for CIP, we're seeing that between the two manuals that they're pretty equal across the board. The only one that points out as higher is the 6th Street sidewalk, and that's because they require you to evaluate flow control and water quality, so it would require a higher review, but the end result would be the same. And then I did want to point out the other thing that we looked at because we heard some concerns from the council committees about the small projects. We took a look back at 2015 projects that were submitted, and there are 61 projects, and of those, 31 were small projects, which we would consider 2, 3, or 4 lot short plats. And of those 31 projects, 13 of those projects would actually require a tank under King County and not under Ecology. And so, again, we found that these tanks range between 4,000 to 5,000 cubic feet, which is equivalent to about an 8-foot diameter tank, 115 feet to 130, I believe. And then it would cost probably between $40,000 to $50,000 to construct. We also looked forward.
We have a question for you.
Uh-huh.
But related to that, there's the policy discussion about whether or not who the tank would be the responsibility of in future, but there's also the sidewalk. So when it's in the right of way, it would be Kirkland's responsibility. Anything that's in the on the private property would be the homeowner's responsibility. Does that trigger that need again for HOA necessarily, or is that are we inspecting the permeable pavement and making sure it's being maintained properly? Where's the city's responsibility there?
That's an issue we're struggling with internally. Currently, city code states that the adjacent property owner is responsible for the sidewalk, for, say, sweeping it and taking care of right-of-way plantings. But it is a good question. If it's permeable pavement, I'm not sure if it's reasonable to expect a homeowner to maintain it in a way that keeps its drainage function working.
And that's in the right-of-way, but I think the question also is what happens on the private part of the property. So if the driveway is permeable pavement or anything else on the site, whose responsibility is it to make sure that it keeps working and is properly maintained?
Yeah, so the city would need to inspect those facilities, and what that means is yet to be determined, whether we do, say, infiltration testing on a permeable pavement driveway. But we would need to inspect those facilities and somehow assure that they're still there, still functioning, and then ask the property owner to maintain. And there are documents that are currently being used when low-impact development is put on a site that notify the owner that they are responsible for those facilities.
So is this like a deed clause or a clause on the plat that gives an inspection easement to the city or something like that? I mean, how does that actually legally work?
So we have a blanket. Our city code contains language that says that city personnel have the right to inspect drainage facilities. And then there is the document is recorded against the title of the property.
Okay. So.
Mr. Asher.
We've had previous code enforcement officers absolutely take the opposite approach, that that's private property, we can't go on it. So I'd like to make sure we're clear on that. And if we have a question, I would think that an easement going along with something like that should be very explicit.
Yeah, just like a utility easement or something,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Ms. Clova.
But that reminds me also of something that was brought up during one of the committees where, you know, in that example where you have the four-lot short plat with the central driveway or central little street thing and then the four driveways, when someone, you know, gets to the end of the life cycle of that permeable pavement and goes, gosh, that stuff was a pain in the butt. I'm going to, you know, asphalt this thing. I don't think people typically think to look at the deed that's or whatever attached to their title to go, what improvements can I make on my home? A lot of times, even if they have read it at the point of purchase, those are vocabulary words that don't really have a lot of meaning to people necessarily, and they don't understand their role as a whole ecosystem. So I hesitate a little bit, like, I guess that just has to be factored into the whole conversation about how, if we give this control up or the inspection or the maintenance responsibilities, then how certain are we that those things are going to happen?
Yeah. There would need to be quite a bit of education. I could see something where maybe the first time we inspect these things, we include information with the inspection letter about what this is, why you have it.
So we have Mr. Asher and Mr. Nixon.
Yeah, I would go back, and I meant to pick it up earlier. That on someone's driveway that's clearly out of the right-of-way is one issue. I've long contended that our claim that the adjacent property owner has responsibility for the city-required facility is unenforceable, and that's our responsibility. So I would think that we would plan for that or have someone give me some very clear information that that is enforceable, and I wouldn't want to be on the receiving end of the comments from the community saying, oh, yeah, you came in and put this in, or some developer down the street who was connecting something put this in, and now you're saying I have to expend my time and effort to maintain it? No.
Thank you. Mr. Nixon?
Yeah, I mean, just to respond to that, it kind of goes back to the discussion we had, I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, about sidewalks being cracked by tree roots, and whether it was the city's responsibility to fix those.
For and the city-required tree.
Yeah, because it was a city-required tree. And my recollection is that we were advised by the city attorney that we could enforce it, even though we normally don't, right? We're often in there with city crews fixing those sidewalks because they're trip hazards, and we don't want to get sued over it, right? Now, I don't know. I mean, if we had an inspection program and we weren't being effective at enforcing the maintenance, could the federal government or state ecology come in and sue the city to say you have ineffective enforcement? I mean, what's our kind of legal risk in terms of the degree of harshness of the enforcement that we need to do? I know you're not an attorney. So.
Yeah. So
I'm kind of asking Kurt this question.
It would be a matter of, again, inspecting, and then we have to have enforcement authority. Whether somebody complies with your enforcement action or not, I'm not sure if we could be held liable for that. Mm-hmm. So as long as we have the process in place and the tools.
So the question I was actually going to ask before I responded to Dave was, if you get back to the idea of education and informing people, if we look at the current disclosure form that realtors have to use when somebody's buying a property or listing a property for sale, does that currently include anything about LID and mandatory city maintenance and those kind of things? And you know, I'm kind of half suggesting that maybe it should, but I know realtors hate to add things to that list because it's just one more thing.
And nobody reads it.
And people don't often read it.
Well,
but,
on the title reports they do.
Yeah.
Because it's evident. It's pretty evident there.
Yeah, so if there was something that was attached to the deed, then your title report would show.
Yeah.
How many people actually read that at the time they're buying a house, or are you just going through the stack of 100 pages and signing everything? That's why I kind of think it's more useful if it's something you see at the time you're considering making an offer. Like, you know if there's a homeowners association that you're going to have to pay dues to or not in advance. You don't discover that at closing. And it would be nice if people were aware of this requirement at that time, so they weren't surprised about it later. I just don't know what the answer is in terms of what disclosures are currently required, so that would be an interesting thing to find
out. Yeah, we could look into that.
Is this as major a shift of public policy onto entangling individual residents as I think it is? Are there other things that, you know, just our everyday that I'm not sensitive to?
It is a big change because it's trying to get water soaked back into the ground, stormwater sort of where it's created, if you will, as opposed to sending it off down the road to making it someone else's problem. So, it is a big shift.
Ms. Sweet? So.
There's so much that feels like it's to be determined. Both, you know, the homeowner, making homeowners associations to how we're going to do the educational process. And this is going to happen in December 31st?
Yeah, we have the regulations
in every city.
Yes.
So where is the overwhelming effort to make sure that people are informed and in a way that people do know what responsibilities are? I mean, this really feels iffy. I mean, Shelley's question with regard to, well, what if I've always wanted to have an asphalt driveway?
Right.
And So I've got this one that kind of freezes in the wintertime and I have ice problems with it. Well, where is it in my thinking that is going to trigger what I can and can't do? And I'm sure it will be in our permitting office. But it seems to me like there's a major effort that's going to have to go out there. And particularly now when we're at one of the biggest development times of forever. We've got so much stuff going up without any of this consideration. Mm-hmm. So where's that all going to come from? And certainly not from each individual city, I hope.
No, there are several regional forums. There's one called Roadmap. There's other NPDES coordinators forums where we're getting together and brainstorming and trying to look at ideas. And I think, frankly, it will be sort of a trial and error process where lots of different cities will try things, we'll see what works, and then we'll adopt the means that do work. And again, we are all in this together, and low-impact development or not is sort of not a choice in this permit. It's a choice between packages that we have before us tonight. So,
well, that aspect is a corollary to another aspect that I talked with Kurt about today. This is a major... Both water quality and I can't remember the other aspect that I picked out are major changes in things that we are doing and costs that we are bearing as a government with no additional revenues.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that, in fact, as we discuss it here, the impact on the individual owner is such that we need to make sure that we have, and I call it a public information campaign. Mm-hmm. This is important stuff to relay, and it's a public information campaign that is effective only to those that are here, those that move in the next day after the last thing. Oh, it's all news to them.
Right. Don't ask me.
Yeah, so I don't know how you keep that current. But we need a better channel of communication on things like this, particularly.
Toby?
Okay. What do we do in the way of, I know a little bit of this, but education of our residents about their responsibilities to existing stormwater facilities? Like, I know we talk about keeping the gutters cleared of leaves and those kind of things, but how about people who have stormwater vaults or underground culverts and their responsibilities associated with them? Do we do any education on that today?
In that we inspect those facilities every 2 years, and our inspector is great at offering to meet with people and explain why their facilities are there, ways that they can maintain them that are at the least cost possible. Mm-hmm. So it's really one-on-one education, and combined with that inspection program, which has a series of notification letters that go out as part of it.
Well, and I'd say that commercial multifamily property owners and managers are very used to these kind of requirements. Mm-hmm. The major shift here is on the single family mm-hmm. residential homeowner.
Mm-hmm.
And it will be a shock, and there will be a lot of outreach, just as 20 years ago there was with, you know, commercial property owners. It was a new requirement.
Mm-hmm. Probably I was going to ask that question. 20 years ago. I know you're not done with your presentation, but is there... And I gather from the memo that with commercial and multifamily, not much is going to change. Is that right?
They will have to consider the use of low-impact development as it's feasible on their sites. So they will have a similar level of change.
And this similar between the King County and the ecology, or have we done that comparison with commercial and multifamily?
I think they would be very similar, and it depends on soil conditions. If the soils are very good, in the past they would have done an infiltration vault to completely manage stormwater. That would be exactly the same today because that counts as low-impact development. In areas of very poor soils, low-impact development would not be feasible. So, again, it would be exactly the same. It's those sites that have kind of the middle of the road soils in terms of infiltration and groundwater levels that will see the biggest change. So they will need to try to fit in low impact development facilities.
Do we have an idea about to Dave's point, about the manpower that it's going to take to have an enforcement process, an inspection process? How many people is that going to be? How many hours? How many FTEs? How it's going to be paid for? Budget impact? Do we have that yet?
So we've been discussing that as part of the 17-18 budget process.
So you're going to get a lot of that in the budget discussions.
Yeah. Along with additional revenue ideas.
The reality is almost all of this can be done by the stormwater rate, so that's part of the rate discussion that not so much for tonight, but in the budget. But I think your macro point is it is a bit of a federal and state unfunded Band-Aid, but the way you react to the unfunded Band-Aid is through your stormwater rates. So there's a mechanism, but it's a local mechanism to respond to a federal and state requirement.
Well, I don't have any problem with this mandate because we've been polluting our waters, and now we're muddling through to not pollute our waters. This is probably not the final solution, and it'll probably be improved significantly over time, but I'm happy that we're not going to be polluting our waters. How we get there is the painful part.
So I guess to your point about the unknowns, I mean, part of the way we start solving the unknowns is by picking the path and then beginning to build around the path. So we've been leading up to that and to tonight so we can get final direction. And then we can begin to say, okay, now that we know which way we're going, we can start to build the concrete programs around it and fund them through the budget process and all that.
Okay, so I want to make sure we get to our
recommendations. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you want to do the final one?
Yeah. Okay. Well, okay, so still focusing kind of back to those smaller projects and those ones that would require a tank versus no tank. We also did a look forward to the 2035 and using the 2035 comp plan and the capacity analysis. And of that, it's a very conservative analysis because 2015 was a very busy year for us. And of that, 13 of them would have required tanks. So this 443 is a very conservative number. But those are the parcels that range between 15 to 20,000 square feet, which are the projects that or parcel sizes that we think would be impacted the most with this tank versus no tank. That would have to provide tanks under King County. And most of these parcels are in the Forbes Creek Basin, Juanita Basin, and Champaign watersheds. And then I wanted to note that there's about 1,200 parcels total within that capacity analysis from 2015 to 2035. So it's about a third. These small projects are about a third of our projects in Kirkland. And so if we decide, one of the policy decisions we're bringing is whether we require the tanks or don't require the tanks. And if we don't require the tanks, it could be a significant, it's hard to quantify, but it could be a significant impact to our streams because a third of these developments that are coming down the line in the next 20 years would not be required to provide detention.
I thought we were required to do the tanks no matter what.
For these smaller,
these are for these small projects.
This is the difference between, these are for those smaller projects and the differences between the packages, where King County requires tanks for these 15,000 to 20,000 square foot lots where Ecology would not.
Okay, so again, the considerations for choosing a package include the construction cost, life cycle cost, maintenance cost. We're doing our best to quantify those things, but it's a little bit unknown because these manuals are new. Again, King County is much more skeptical of the long-term viability of low-impact development, so has that more conservative approach. King County package is preferred by the development community. They like the sort of consistency among jurisdictions. The city is currently using the 2009 King County Surface Water Design Manual, so there's some continuity there. And then King County is offering, so far anyway, excellent technical support for their design manual.
Mr. Arnold and Mr. Asher.
For other consideration, I noticed that the Ecology Manual was adopted in 2014, the King County Manual adopted in 2016.
Yeah.
One of the things that we're dealing with is kind of the sticker shock with critical areas where we are in the process of updating our critical areas regulations that are have been kind of behind the times. Mm-hmm. Does either ecology or King County set us up better for the future, given that King County has been adopted more recently for when the next council has to do this again mm-hmm. in 8 or 10 years?
So in the past, ecology and King County have really leapfrogged. Like King County has gone out in front, then ecology sort of copies them, and it's kind of gone forward that way. I would say with these two manuals, they're much more similar than King County and ecology have been in the past. So I think they would both be fairly equal in terms of setting us up for the future, with the exception that, you know, one provides a lot more detention volume, and if LID does not work as we hope, there's a possibility that the city would have to circle back around and provide that detention later.
Mr. Asher?
You made the point that the King County manual is more process-oriented. You follow mm-hmm. these steps, you mm-hmm. check these boxes, you've done what you need to do. Mm-hmm. Whereas ecology is more outcome oriented. Mm-hmm. I'm an outcome kind of guy. And following the steps is one thing, but achieving the outcomes to me is that's the ultimate measure of are we doing what we are supposed to do. How do we marry those?
I would say that the King County manual is more like a recipe that has the picture and the directions for how to get to that picture.
Does it achieve the outcome, though?
Yeah, and the mm-hmm. ecology manual has, you know, the recipe and the picture. The advantage of having the instructions there, if you will, is that it's much clearer what's expected, both for people designing the project and the people reviewing the project. So there's, and this may be my personal opinion, a little more certainty that you'll get there. Sometimes with the ecology manual, there may be more flexibility. There's also maybe more items that can be tweaked, and it's hard to know if that outcome is exactly the same. So, do you?
No, I think you handled that. You know, your question is really good, and both manuals are intended to achieve the outcome. Because ecology is outcome-based, it feels more like you will get there. But as Jenny says, if you don't have a clear path on how to get there, you know, maybe that's harder. Either way works, and either way complies. I think the biggest difference between the two really is the flood protection and conveyance, and most particularly for Kirkland, what happens to these small short plats. I think that really is the biggest difference between the two.
But would we achieve the outcome? Would we be more likely to achieve the outcome if we did like we do on a number of development projects, require them to bond for a certain number of years, that at that end of that time they are performing? Is that something that's a pathway to achieve an outcome and still allow checking the boxes as they go along as their process?
I think ecology and King County are both prescriptive in that they say if you built this thing, you're done. And there's an assumption that that thing is going to serve the purpose it was designed for. So there, I don't know of a municipality out there that bonds for function.
As and if they're wrong, like, it's on us.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Thanks.
Okay. So it is possible to alter these two packages. If the ecology package were adopted, again, given the recommendation to continue to include conveyance protection and flood protection, staff would recommend adding that to the ecology package.
Question?
Sorry.
So if we did that, mm-hmm. would we then have the King County package effectively?
No, that would be adopting the ecology manual, which is a different design.
But then you add the additional manual. Things that King County already has. What would then be the gap between the two?
What we could do is adopt ecology's manual plus our current policies and requirements related to flood control and flood protection and conveyance. So we could do that. It wouldn't mean that we would have to 100% wholesale exactly adopt what King County does. And a couple of the jurisdictions actually have done this. They've adopted ecology's manual, but they didn't want to go quite so far as King County in conveyance and flood control. So they adopted their own little package for conveyance and flood control.
So what I'm hearing is that if we did what was on the preceding slide, what we would effectively have is something between the ecology and King County models. Is that right?
Yeah, and I guess staff would recommend that we get there almost from the opposite end of things, which is taking the King County package and tweaking it so that it meets the ecology standards in terms of requiring those small tanks. So, again, for the King County package, option one would be adopting it as is, which would require those tanks for small projects. Option two would be adopting the King County package, but changing that one threshold for requiring flow control. And then option three is an idea that we came up with as staff. I think the more we talk about it, we're a little bit lukewarm. Mm-hmm. We heard mixed things from the council committees, which is fee in lieu, which would be providing those small projects, which would have to put in a tank under King County but not under ecology, just those projects could voluntarily pay into a fund rather than building that tank. And the city would then use that funding to plan for facilities on a watershed scale. And some pros of that is it would potentially reduce construction costs depending on what you set your fee in lieu at. It would certainly be easier, perhaps more easier for the developer. They wouldn't have to fit that tank on their site. Some of the cons are that it would be a lot more expensive for the city to build that detention later just because of the nature of CIP projects and the need for transparency. A cubic foot of storage built as a capital project by the city versus one built by a private developer is a lot more expensive. So, plus, if you wait to build, obviously costs go up. So it would be a lot more expensive to build that same amount of detention down the road. And it's unclear that we would collect enough money with this. Because development is spread out, you don't have a lot of control over when and sort of where it happens. You may not collect enough money to do the planning, much less build the facilities. So,
when I saw that, I felt the looming sidewalk concomitant agreement debacle. And I said, no.
Okay, so to get to the recommendation, staff recommendation is to adopt the King County package as is. So that's that option one. Again, fee in lieu was an option that we have came up with. I think there's pros and cons, and I think at this point we're fairly lukewarm about it as a staff recommendation. And then with either of whatever way we go to conduct a study that would help with some feasibility tools for low impact development and other things that would help sort of compare. Did we make, is this the right choice and make the process as easy as possible for the development community as we move forward? So that would be that study.
I don't think of them as the development community necessarily. Yeah. I think of them as our residents who are ultimately going to be dealing with this. So I think it's easy for me, developers making too much money, no problem. Let's make it harder for them. To me, it's our residents who are going to be paying for this and all the way along. Yes, Mr. Asher, please.
It seems like there are things that we want to modify in the King County approach that, to me, saying adopt as is doesn't allow for. I thought I heard that in your earlier conversations and your analysis that we don't want to take either one just as it sits. So as is means as is, and what we have are some modifications that we want to make. Are you backing away from all that by saying?
No, and I neglected to mention, with the King County Manual, there would be an addendum that talks about implementation details, but that's more how we do plan review specific details of how we do that in Kirkland, and that would be with the King County package. So but again, this option two would be to tweak that one threshold.
But that's with ecology. I'm talking about just using King County, which is your recommendation.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought throughout that I thought the assumption was that we have some additional things that aren't covered in either of these that we would want to. So as is says, period. There's nothing in addition. But I think I heard that we want King County, and then we've got
the Kirkland addendum. Right.
Yes, there would be a Kirkland addendum. I should have added that
okay.
in there.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Thanks.
Ms. Wheat, so why can't we adopt King County and somehow result in no tanks for smaller projects on short plots?
That would be this option,
we
too.
We can. That's option two.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Uh-huh. No, that's ecology.
That says ecology. No.
So,
ecology threshold in the King
County. The ecology threshold.
Okay.
So it would be changing that one threshold such that those tanks would not be required. We checked with ecology, and they confirmed that would be acceptable, because that is that specific threshold is considered above and beyond what ecology requires. So that is very much an option.
So are you trying to get an answer tonight on these options, some direction?
Yes.
We're hoping to, yes.
The recommendation.
Yeah, I know it's not a lot of time. So.
But the recommendation is King County.
Yes.
Recommendation is King County.
With all choices.
But King County won.
King County won, yes.
Could you go back to the King County choices?
Yeah. The King County, okay, yeah.
But this isn't like the comp plan, right? You can
amend.
There
you
go.
You can amend.
Other direction, sorry.
Go back one.
There we go. Fine. Okay.
So, Dan, I want to be clear. You can amend the drainage manual over time. It's not like the comp plan where you can only do it like once a year, right? So if we adopt this, you can tweak this. And one of the reasons we want the study is to say, okay, if we got it wrong, we can come back as well. But the issue of whether or not you create the higher threshold is one that could also, be addressed again in the future. So, but whether we're going to adopt the King County Manual as the framework is really the big question that's got to be answered. And ideally, the other ones would be answered as well. But it's not one-and-done decision. You can come back and amend.
But I would hope that tonight we can dump the fee and lieu concept.
Mr. Arnold.
Okay. So I'm in favor of option one, given wanted to thank Kelly and Jenny for the thorough analysis in the packet on both packages and running them through different projects. There's a lot of great data in there and in your presentation this evening. But the thing that really jumped out at me is where we have the development potential in our city is and how many of those lots are on slopes where flow control are an issue, and I like the taking the most conservative approach, which would be the King County Manual, given stuff in the development potential in the Forbes Creek Basin, on Finn Hill, and on Champagne Point. For all of this, and I think this came pretty clear in the materials, it would be a lot easier to adopt a manual in that is more conservative now, and then look over time on how to back off on requirements versus adding requirements back in, because not only is that more difficult from a process standpoint, it is becomes the city's responsibility to fix the problems that were created with our own stormwater facilities if we guess wrong. So option one, I'm in favor of. Fee in lieu is interesting. I'd love to see a committee report back to the committees to look at that, because the thing that was most interesting about that is how can we centralize in areas that are developing, are there opportunities to centralize the stormwater and have that kind of flexibility? And I'm interested in learning about that, but that can happen again at a later point.
So, yes, Mr. Asher and Mr. Nixon.
The concern I have with the fee in lieu of is it may have to be basin specific, because there may be differences in drainage basins as to what are the kinds of things that work in that particular, and it's gonna have to go back to the nexus requirement that starts us off. So I think it could be just so complicated that it may end up being a concomitant agreement just in its complexity.
I think we may not have a clear direction either way. Are you for option one then, or option two?
Yeah, I'm for option. I'm for the King County manual, okay. Which I think is option one, with our local additions, or with all slight alterations is what it says.
Kirkland addendum.
Thank you, Toby.
So, and I concur.
Okay.
I support option one with our tweaks. I would like to not try to craft the fee and lieu program before the end of this year, but we can consider that in the future. And I agree with Dave that I think it needs to be something where it's not just a flat fee citywide, but it's going to have to be. We look at a particular area and see that there's several opportunities for development where we might be able to create a shared facility, and then we offer it there, as opposed to just everywhere.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Ms. Cloak?
So I like the option one as is, and I think that the more conservative approach is important, because part of what's echoing in my mind, as you know, I read through the packet and we've seen this in committee, is those folks who are next door to, or you know, slightly downstream of the folks who are doing something new and different to their property. And you know, we've heard the stories where, well, you know, my neighbor developed and now there's two houses and now my backyard floods.
Right.
So there's, and we do hear a fair bit of that. So I think erring on the side of caution, being more conservative, really kind of respects the people who, you know, were here first and are not making the changes, and helping to shield them a little bit from the impacts of what their neighbors might be doing.
Thank you. Ms. Sweet.
Well, begrudgingly, I still support.
You got to pick something.
You got to pick something. You know, I'm willing to go ahead with option one, but I sure hope that over a period of time we can evaluate. This is an enormous cost to add, and if there is an opportunity for us to evaluate these and take a look and see that potentially something like fee in lieu could allow us to do mitigation in some way somewhere else that's going to make it better, or you know, so I don't want to be stuck with the King County plus the Kirkland addendum. Mm-hmm. And the Kirkland addendum does do what you talk about in terms of looking out 25 feet and looking at how long, right? Isn't that the Kirkland addendum?
25
years. Oh, downstream
years.
Analysis. Downstream analysis is actually required by the King County manual. So.
Oh, it is?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah,
all right. Anyway, I'm willing to go along with option one if I have to, and I can count. And ultimately, I think that there might be a worthy investigation for fee and lieu, depending on what we learn the next year.
Okay. So I am in favor of option two, but I can also count. So it sounds like there's a consensus around option one, and bring us back some information about option fee and lieu as... Yes, sir.
Well, you can finish your sentence.
Well, I think we're interested in looking... having a committee study fee and lieu options and bringing back recommendations at a later time.
Well, and I also wanted to say I just agree with Councilmember Sweet. I think that I would be more comfortable with option two once we have more experience with LID and we're more confident that it's not going to have impacts on neighboring properties, because it actually clogs up quicker than we expect, or whatever, and we end up with more runoff. So when we finish this discussion, I have a couple of tangential points I want to raise, but I'll wait until we're done with this.
Well, I think we've got direction.
Right? I have one.
Yes,
one tangential point too, but before we leave fee and lieu, I want to make sure that when we capture the fee, you have to make this attractive enough to the developer that it is a cost-effective choice for them to make, that the cost of the planning and the construction what I would expect is a basin approach, is included in that, so we don't end up handling the bill for all that. And we come up with how many developers have to sign up, how many properties have to sign up for us to have enough money to do in that basin what's material. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's a bet.
Yeah,
because you can't make them make the choice. Well, no, I guess you could make them make the choice, actually.
So retrofit planning and looking at retrofits for watersheds and how to deal with all the existing development, which actually is the majority of the development that happened without flow controls, and doing that retrofit planning and watershed planning is another function of the utility and something that will be continuing in some form, and this would be sort of one small part of that. So
do you have what you need from us?
We do, thank you.
Yeah,
okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jay and Kelly. Oh, Mr. Nixon, I'm sorry, the
tangential
point. Yeah.
So I'll just do both of them. They should be simple. So my understanding is our current LID chapter has incentives. And if we're going to LID being mandatory, does that mean that the chapter has to be rewritten to eliminate the incentives?
Yes, we are in the process of doing that. A related project to this is the LID code review. That's going to the Planning Commission first on September 29th, and Chapter 114 changes are part of that.
Okay.
Yeah.
And my second question, this is really tangential, is in this most recent rain event, there were some folks who posted on Facebook about backyard flooding that they believe was a result of beaver dams. And I don't know that that's directly related to this, but I wanted to just ask the question. What's this official city policy on drainage issues that come about because of beaver activity?
So with beavers in particular, we look at whether a public facility is affected when deciding whether to step in as a city and assist. Mm-hmm. If it's, say, blocking a culvert under a road, then the city will step in and get a proper permit from Fish and Wildlife and unblock the culvert. On private property, we try to direct them to technical assistance and beaver management classes. There are a lot of different ways you can build gadgets that can help with beaver problems on private property.
But effectively, if it's just a creek is backing up and approaching their house, it's their issue to deal with. It's not directly a city thing.
Unless there's a public facility involved, okay. Yeah.
Thanks.
Well, how about animal control?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that an animal control issue?
Not covered by our current animal control.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
The tangential issue I talked with Jenny about it earlier today, are ravines that we have. And there are a lot of ravines mm-hmm. that in our city that surprisingly a number. Mm-hmm. The setbacks from streams on ravines, and I'm not, my question today was, where is this covered? Is it critical areas ordinance? Is it this? Whatever. But the setbacks occur from the high water mark of the water. In ravines, that setback could be exhausted before you get to the lip of the ravine. Mm-hmm. We need some way of protecting that. And did you find an answer as to
So I did talk to planning, and I believe that Joan Lieberman Brill will be writing back to you about that.
Okay.
But it is a combination of Chapter 85, which deals with steep slopes and landslide hazards, and the critical areas ordinance. And so if that slope is over a certain percentage, then there would have to be geotechnical studies and potentially setbacks from that slope that would protect it.
Okay. Yeah, I'd be interested in that. Because that's we've had, since we've been looking at critical areas and setbacks and things, this has been an issue that we've just never had a good idea to how to address. Thank you.
Yeah.
Are those setbacks in ravines measured on the land surface, or are they measured as though it was flat?
On the land surface.
It's on the
from
land
the
surface.
From the high water mark.
Interesting.
Of the water, yeah.
Fun question for the planning department.
Yes, that's right.
So we're going to go into executive session to discuss pending and potential litigation, and we'll return for our regular scheduled programming at 7:30.
What's your setback?
Yes, even though...
Good evening and welcome. Apologies for the late start.
few technical issues. We're back in session following a study session to review the surface water design requirements update and an executive session with our city attorney to discuss potential and pending litigation. Councilmember Marchione is absent from tonight's meeting. Is there a motion to excuse her?
So moved.
Second.
Thank you. It's moved by Councilmember Asher, seconded by Councilmember Sweet, to approve, to excuse Ms. Marchione from this evening's meeting. Will all those in favor please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Thank you very much. The motion is approved. Ms. Anderson, would you call the roll for our regular meeting, please?
Councilmember Nixon?
Here.
Councilmember Kloba?
Here.
Councilmember Asher?
Here.
Councilmember Sweet?
Here.
Deputy Mayor Arnold?
Here.
Mayor Wallen?
Here. Thank you very much. And I think I'm going to switch things up a little bit, if you don't mind, that we'll do the proclamation, the Welcoming Week proclamation at this time. And Councilmember Kloba is going to read that proclamation with me. City Manager.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Mayor. So we have Debbie Lacey of the Eastside Refugee and Immigrant Coalition here to accept the proclamation. And she also wants to say a few words on behalf of Welcoming Week. So welcome. What up, Debbie?
Hello, Debbie. Good to see you. Okay, so a proclamation. Whereas the population on the east side has grown rapidly since 2010, increasing by over 79,000 residents in the last 6 years, and whereas 30% of these newcomers have arrived from places outside the United States, and whereas more than one-third of Eastside residents now speak a language other than English at home, and whereas diversity is the lifeblood of our community, bringing fresh perspectives and new ideas, innovation and entrepreneurial spirit, leadership and hard workers, and whereas our success depends on ensuring that all our residents feel welcome here, we, therefore, so this is from all the local mayors. The mayors of Bellevue, Issaquah, Kirkland, Redmond, Sammamish proclaim September 16th through 25th, 2016 as Eastside Welcoming Week in our cities. And we call on all our residents to join together to build stronger communities across the East Side.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I really appreciate being here again. I'm Debbie Lacey. I'm with the Eastside Refugee and Immigrant Coalition. The city of Kirkland has been an active and engaged member of ERIC since its inception in 2002. In fact, I co-founded it with Carrie Height, who was with your Parks and Community Services Department at the time. So I am currently a resident and have been of Kirkland for 12 years. My son just started kindergarten in the Lake Washington District at A.G. Bell. And I'm really proud to be part of this community and the efforts moving forward to continue to honor the diversity. And I wanted to let all of you know that ERIC is a member of Welcoming America, which is a national movement. We're having Welcoming Week in honor of everything that they're doing to create welcoming and inclusive communities. And we, at ERIC, intend to be a resource for municipalities, organizations, groups, anyone that is really wanting to know how do you go about creating inclusivity, equity, welcoming. How do you do this systemically? How do you have the compassion and the courage to make connections across different barriers? And we want to be a support for that. So anyone here that is interested in participating in Welcoming Week, please go to ericmembers.org, that's E-R-I-C, and look up the calendar. There's lots of free fun events happening for the remainder of this special week, and we have gifts, buttons for everyone. Leslie's going to help pass those out. So thank you again. We really appreciate the City of Kirkland's support and the proclamation honoring this special week. Thank you.
Thank you. And we really want to do some activities next year. So I know that you've been working with Leslie, and hopefully we can keep that work going because we'd like to do some activities.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Leslie. The next item on our agenda is another proclamation. It's National Pollution Prevention Week. City Manager.
Okay, thank you, Mayor. So it's sort of fitting after a study session discussion on how to keep our waterways in Lake Washington clean of pollution that we are also doing a proclamation to proclaim September 19th through 25th as National Pollution Prevention Week in Kirkland. This is the second year the city of Kirkland has recognized this, and we'll be celebrating with our neighbor jurisdiction, the city of Bothell. And as you saw in the memo, there are many programs throughout the city of Kirkland where we do programs that range from the police drug take-back program, but many, many, many of them are in the Public Works Department. So here to receive the proclamation is Kathy Brown, our Public Works Director, and Ryan Marie Tomisto, who's in the Public Works section, will be joining her.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Asher will be joining me.
Proclamation of the City of Kirkland designating September 19th through 25th, 2016 as National Pollution Prevention Week in Kirkland, Washington. Whereas the United States Environmental Protection Agency acknowledges National Pollution Prevention Week in honor of the United States Congress passing the Pollution Prevention Act in 1990, and whereas the Pollution Prevention Act encourages pollution prevention by reducing or eliminating waste at the source by modifying production processes, promoting the use of non-toxic or less toxic substances, implementing conservation techniques, and reusing materials rather than putting them into the waste stream. And whereas the City Council's environmental goal is to protect the natural environment through integrated natural resource management, and whereas the City of Kirkland is a leader implementing programs and processes to prevent pollution, such as, but not limited to, the local source control business audits, free spill kit distribution, spill response and cleanup, after-hours response, food service waste, fats, oils, and grease inspections, public works development review and inspection, solid waste recycling, compost, styrofest, Kirkland Green Building Program, Solarize Kirkland, the Drug Take-Back Program, Cross Kirkland Corridor Maintenance, Street Sweeping, Stream and Wetland Management, Tree Management Regulations, Neighborhood Pathway and Sidewalk Improvements, and whereas these services are provided by a diverse workforce with a variety of backgrounds and experience levels that share a common goal of protecting public health and the environment by reducing or eliminating sources of pollution before they enter our environment, including our wetlands, streams, and lakes, and prevent the need for costly controls and cleanup responses. Now, therefore, Amy Wallen, Mayor of Kirkland, hereby proclaims the week of September 29th to 25th, 2016, as National Pollution Prevention Week in the City of Kirkland, Washington, and calls upon citizens to protect natural resources by reducing and eliminating pollution at its sources. Signed this 20th day of September, just now, 2016. Thank
you very much. The next item on our agenda is communications. It's items from the audience. This is the time in our meeting when we hear from the public on matters which are not quasi-judicial or otherwise scheduled for public hearing. We ask that not more than three people speak on any one subject. However, if both proponents and opponents wish to speak, then up to three proponents and up to three opponents may address the council. Do we have a sign-in sheet? We have no sign-in sheet. Is there anyone who wishes to address the council at this time? We'd love to hear from you. Seeing none, I'll declare this items from the audience period closed. And we'll move on to the consent calendar. Before we have a motion, I'd like to ask Deputy Mayor Arnold to present the audit of accounts.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. We had payroll in the amount of $3,214,767.75 and bills in the amount of $4,583,179.83.
Thank you. Mr. Asher.
Madam Mayor, I'd like to move first and final reading of the consent calendar.
Second.
Thank you. It's been moved by Councilmember Asher and seconded by Councilmember Sweet to approve the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? Well, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, say no. Thank you. The motion is approved and the consent calendar is approved. With music. All right. The next item on our agenda is a public hearing about proposed revenue sources for the 2017-2018 budget. First, I'll ask the staff to make a presentation. Good evening. City Manager.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Mayor. So, this is the public hearing. We have Tom Meixel, our financial planning manager, is going to provide an overview of our revenue sources and also some budget assumptions and talk a little bit about the upcoming budget process before we take any testimony from the public. So take it away, Tom.
Thank you, City Manager, Mayor, Deputy Mayor, members of council. As mentioned, tonight is the public hearing dealing with revenue sources for the 2017-18 budget. It is our first of three public hearings that we'll have during budget season this fall. In addition to the public hearing, giving the opportunity for the public to speak, it also gives me an opportunity to update you on where we are with regards to developing the 2017-18 budget and the 17 through 22 capital improvements program. So to start, I'd just like to cover the budget principles that the city manager has provided to help us put together the city's budget for the next biennium. So we're continuing the stay steady philosophy in light of the expiration of the sales tax credit in 2021. One change is in the past, we had been planning for the expiration of the use of REIT for temporary operations and maintenance in 2016. Due to a legislative change last year, we are now able to use REIT on an ongoing basis. However, it needs to be for maintenance only of projects that are REIT eligible. So we are exercising that to the extent that it makes sense on an ongoing basis. Next, we, as mentioned, we are planning on the sales tax credit expiring in 2021. Part of that strategy, we're budgeting sales taxes on a modified two-year lag approach, meaning we set the next 2 years based on our most recent actuals, which is 2016 in this case. There are a number of one-time service packages that were approved in 15 and 16 that are likely to continue. I'll talk a little bit more about that later, including the cost. New service packages are meant to be those that are supported by new revenues or reductions in spending in the base. Also on that philosophy of service packages is the intent to set aside funds for one-time needs, so matching one-time resources with one-time needs, or to decrease backlogs or increase efficiencies. Finally, final budget principle is to keep non-expenditure cost growth zero, except in those cases where it's beyond our control. So I just want to stop really briefly, since the last time we talked budget with you was at the May retreat regarding the forecast. So there are a few kind of high-level things that we're noticing as we're developing the base. One is that the salary and wages benefits, salary and wages budget reflects attrition. So the 2016 forecast was based off of a 2016 budget level that was actually set in fall of 2014 because we do biennial budget. So the process of updating that, the replacement of seasoned staff who have left with newer staff who are lower on the salary schedule, including the implementation of the COLA adjustments as bargaining agreements have closed, results in a rebasing of our salary budget for 2017. Also, the budget for NORCOM in 2016 was higher than the actual amount. The forecast included growth from the 2016 amount, so that in essence rolls into the 2017-18 budget as savings. On the revenue side, consistently, we've been receiving high levels of punch board and card games revenues for the last 3 years. We've updated the baseline assumption to reflect that trend. Development fees, as you are aware, have been elevated, and they continue to be so. In the forecast, we had scaled them back somewhat. However, based on information from the departments, the higher level, particularly for 2017, is still supported. For CIP charges, you added additional CIP engineering staff in the fall in the mid-biennial budget adjustment. However, the forecast didn't include the additional revenue side of that transaction, so or it didn't include the full amount of the revenue side, and so we're updating that to accurately reflect that. And then finally, the overall philosophy is that the basic budgets are supporting the current service levels submitted by departments in August of this year. So this is more discussion now, moving from the forecast to actual base budget development. So first good news is we are not including any use of reserves in the budget. So we're budgeting on our ongoing based on our ongoing revenue levels. Property taxes, as you're aware, we have a state law that limits us to the greater of 1% or the growth in implicit price deflator plus new construction. Right now, our new construction assumption is 1%. We do expect to get an update from the county assessor shortly, and we'll update our budget projections accordingly. In terms of sales tax, I mentioned earlier, we budget on the modified two-year lag. For 2016, we're estimating to end the year 5% above last year. Currently, we are about 6.9% through August above last year, so we are building in a gradual decline down to the 5% level. For 17 and 18, we're basically assuming no growth. And then the annexation sales tax, we're assuming at the level that we collected, that we budgeted for 2016, which is approximately $4 million. So utility taxes, there's the question of the rate and the question of the base. So in terms of the rates, we are not assuming any changes in those, so neither on the private or public utility tax rate side. In terms of the tax base, private utilities have been underperforming recently, so we are not assuming any growth. They saw a pretty steep drop in 2015 that kind of is carried into 2016, so we're not increasing it, we're not decreasing it. That includes electric, gas, telecom, and cable. The tax rate on all the private utilities is 6% for reference. In terms of the public utilities, so water, sewer, solid waste, and surface water, the rates vary. The effective tax rates vary, as you can see from the slide. The growth rate that we're assuming in the base is essentially whatever is projected for the respective utility rate model.
Yeah, question for you, Mr. Michael. Mr. Asher.
I'm a slide behind you. Sorry. On the sales tax.
Oh.
For 2017, what is the sales tax budget assumption that we're using?
In terms of dollar amounts?
In terms of what is the benchmark?
Right, whatever the 2016 actuals turn out to be. So we're estimating 5% above 15, so we're assuming 0% growth in 17.
Okay, if we've got a two-year lag, where does 2 years in there?
That's the modified part. What we did last biennium when we did the modified two-year lag is we used the 14 estimate as flat for 15 and 16. So this way we'd be using the 16 estimate as flat for 17 and 18, as opposed to a one-year lag, which would be assuming growth in 18. So that's the same assumption that we used in the 15-16 budget as a modified two-year lag, was using the 14 actual, or the estimate for 14 for 15 and 16.
Then I think we need to call it something else because it's not a two-year lag. It's a year prior to the biennium budgeted for. I thought we had gone more to a real two-year lag.
But
it was very proud of that, matter of fact.
Right. No, I think we tried to be clear. It was modified from the technical definition of a complete two-year lag is. So, that's certainly a policy call that the council can make a change to, if you like.
Can you tell me more what you mean exactly?
That we budget in 2017 what was the actual in 2015, and in 2018 the actual for our estimated actual for 2016.
Right.
That's what the 2 year lag that that in fact served us very well when the economic downturns came. Mm-hmm. I thought we'd gotten back to modified was the curiosity, and then I've so, just
so I think to be clear, so what we're doing is instead of holding a two years ago rate, we're holding we'll hold last year's rate for 2 years. So yeah, so the proposal to you, which is of course what we look to the council for final direction on, is we take the 16 number and hold that constant for 17, 18, not the 15 number and hold that constant for 17.
Can you tell us as we go forward, you don't have to have the numbers tonight, what impact that would have?
If we went the other way and went to 15?
Yeah, right. if we did an actual two-year lag.
Right. Sure, we can calculate that.
I would appreciate that.
So when we do that big budget workshop, maybe we can have those, right. The difference between those and what, yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, ready to go.
So having covered utility taxes, development related revenues, I mentioned, still growing hot. However, departments have scaled back their estimates approximately 20% from the 2016 levels going into 2018. To reflect some maturation of the development cycle. Finally, with regards to CPI adjustments, there are some fees that are allowed to have CPI adjustments, and it is expected that those will be taken. So that would include like the EMS fee and some development fees. So business license, so this slide is a combination of a base discussion as well as a proposal. In terms of the base budget, we're assuming a 1% growth in business licenses and business license fee revenue. As noted in the memo to council, city manager is proposing an increase to the RGL, so the revenue generating regulatory license, or in other words, also known as a head tax, because it's based on the number of FTEs at a business. The proposed increase is $5 from the current level of $100, and that would be used the proposal is to use it to fund public safety investments. So this is the first change since the fee was instituted in 2009. The table below includes the different approaches that surrounding communities in the region use in terms of taxation of businesses. So on the left side of the table, you'll see those cities that use a head tax approach similar to Kirkland. On the right side are cities that use a different approach, which is essentially a business and occupations tax on gross receipts or square feet of a business. So this is kind of a mixture of two different approaches. This next slide attempts to normalize the differences between the two for a set of similar businesses along the left scale. So you're going from small to large. So you can see the impacts that for each one of these businesses, according to the different taxing jurisdictions of our closest neighbors. In addition, there is this, a column that's added for the proposal to increase the RGRL, or the head tax, by $5 per FTE. This revenue proposal would bring in approximately $140,000 per year.
So are we increasing the base fee?
The proposal is not to increase the base fee. It would still be $100.
And I'm going to channel Ms. Marchione now and say that that she usually would say transportation infrastructure is what businesses can get behind. I understand the public safety push. Maybe we can reach out to our businesses and explain what the investments are proposed to be. Ms. Sweet.
Just to mention that the city manager presented this at the public policy meeting for the chamber just on Monday, and it was actually pretty well received. First increase since 2009, I think, and not a huge impact. So,
before we leave this topic, I'd like, are you about to leave this topic? It looks like you are.
Yes, this was the last slide on this.
I'd like for us to do a dive into our business licenses on the data that we have on our business licenses. I'd like to look at the number of renewals, the number of discontinuances. In other words, who's dropping off, our FTE growth, we see that through the FTEs that are reported, and the number of new businesses. This is stats that we just don't normally see, and I was trying to think of a way of getting to that, and I think during the budget process it's a good idea to take a look at that, and it seems to be that it's a bit of a thermometer on what's happening with our community businesses too. So if we could do that sometime during the budget process, I think it'd be nice.
Sure.
Could we do that?
Well, I do.
Yes, sir. Mr. Arnold has a question, I think.
In addition, in looking at the head tax, I'd like to see, as we look at this study session, whether this also can, whether we also can consider making this one of the fees that's indexed to inflation. You mentioned this hasn't been raised since 2009. I note that Redmond's business tax is head tax is an odd number that makes it appear, I think they may be indexing to inflation. It may be something that is more predictable versus requiring council action periodically that we want to do, and it's something I'd like to consider.
Good idea.
Other comments? Oh, Ms. Sweet.
I would suggest that we actually sit down and talk with perhaps the chamber before we move into that. The chamber's recollection of how we got to the head tax is a little, they seem to think that we did it temporarily. I was on that committee or on the business side during that time, and I remember very clearly that it wasn't presented that way. But I do think that it would be healthy to have some discussion. I know that Redmond's numbers are associated with, I think, a square footage allotment along with FTEs, so it's a little bit different. I agree that we should probably evaluate it more often, but to automatically tie it to what did you suggest inflation. We tie it to? Inflation. Doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I think understanding some of the data that Dave's talking about in terms of how many businesses stay in business and that kind of stuff will help us with that.
Other comments?
Just to pile onto that, I was one of a couple of council members that did consider it a temporary fee. Yeah. But in looking at the glide slope to where sales tax is versus where it was, we still haven't achieved that point that we would have cast away.
And we're reaching, not all businesses are represented at the chamber. Obviously, we wish that they were, but some of our big players are not.
Right.
Are we reaching out to our larger
players? We're going to keep doing more outreach.
Okay.
But we just had a chance to talk to the Public Policy Committee yesterday.
Great.
But we'll make sure we get this out to everyone. And we're asking the chamber to also communicate it to everyone.
Thank you. Okay, ready to go.
Thanks. Okay, so I am moving on to base budget expenditure side now. So we're assuming full staffing, so no vacancies. We are establishing a COLA reserve. So I mentioned we were settling up the past agreements in terms of developing the base budget for 17 and 18. However, there are a lot of open agreements that will be open for 17 and 18. And we're establishing a reserve that assumes 2% per year raises in anticipation of settling those contracts. In terms of health benefit inflation, we are actually assuming 0% growth for 2017 for our high deductible and prime plans. For the group health, dental, and vision, we are assuming the growth rates given to us by the providers. And then for 2018, we're inflating all costs by 2%. We're assuming approximately $2.5 million for debt service. So that covers City Hall debt, Kirkland Justice Center debt. We have the 1% per year for reserve replenishment, which will get us very close to our reserve targets. Looks like we will be able to hit them by 2019 fully, and which is consistent with the long-range forecast. So now for the 2017-18 budget, we do have a general capital contribution. So we have $1.7 million going to fund a portion of Fire Station 24 construction in the CIP in 2017. We have planned contributions for geographical information systems in the IT CIP at approximately $110,000 per year. And we have $60,000 every other year for emergency generators. And those are all transfers to the capital projects fund. So I've been talking about base budget development, but what we'll be bringing to you in October is the preliminary budget. So there's a step to take place between now and then, and that includes the impact of service packages. So as mentioned, there are a number of 2015-16 service packages that are one-time items. So those total about $1.3 million per year, and it's likely that those will be included in the preliminary budget. Also, the consideration of the service packages that is underway right now, which is actually a good segue into where we are with regards to current progress. So this is at the staff level what we're doing. We've met with all the departments, had two rounds of meetings. We have reviewed our available resources. We're still refining that. We city manager has received the service packages and reviewing those and is developing the recommendation with the intent to very soon wrap up the deliberation phase on the preliminary budget and then move into the production phase so that we can deliver it to you in October. And so this is the upcoming dates. So we have a busy October. On the 18th, we will actually be talking about the CIP. So this is an update, an additional update of the 2017-2022 CIP at a regular council meeting. The 21st, as mentioned, that's when we will deliver the preliminary budget to you. 4 days later, we'll go to the Finance Administration Committee to discuss the recently presented preliminary budget. We have a six-hour council work study session scheduled on the 27th. And with the two additional study sessions as needed on the 1st and 7th of November. In terms of the next two public hearings, on the 17th, we will have a public hearing on the 17-18 budget. And the first hearing on the preliminary 2017 property tax levy public hearing. And then rounding out the process is on December 13th, the adoption of the 17-18 budget, 17 through 22 CIP, and the 17 property tax levy. So that's what I have. Thank you for the opportunity to share the information with you. Do you have any questions?
Thank you for sharing the information. Mr. Asher.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. On the sales tax year-to-date, that wonderfully depressing chart that you portrayed, can we factor out the stores that have been closed for the major developments and look at what the underlying growth of the rest of the city is of the businesses? I think that would be more helpful because we've not really taken into consideration the actions for the redevelopment of those two major places, and I'd like to get a view of it with those taken out, if we could.
Absolutely.
Because we're looking for great things. And what are you planning about including in the – are you making any assumption on the new businesses coming in 17 would be the first new businesses that we would see?
We haven't at this time.
Okay. All right. You had an assumption on non-personnel expenditures being held, and it's held to zero, I think, no growth. Have we ever allowed growth in a budget in non-personnel expenditures other than for special projects? I mean, this is one of the old budgeteering things where you say one thing and what actually happens in the real world is something very different.
We, Councilman Brash, we do try to hold to that standard. It's some items, as I mentioned earlier, are kind of beyond our control. So on the items that are within our control, we do attempt to hold that standard and do a fairly reasonable job. I mean, there are as you noted, areas where it pokes through that assumption a bit, but...
Well, in an operating department, it's a ludicrous proposition. They won't give us any money, but we're going to... Can we look at budget versus actual in areas of non-personnel expenditures over the past... if we can get to a decade, I'd love to see a decade. Because I think, and I've done it myself, issued budget guidance that says, okay, no growth here because we're really tight. We're always really tight. So I think allowing for some growth and understanding some growth up front may be more realistic and take a little bit of the gamesmanship out of the departmental approaches to budgeting.
How difficult is that going to be? Is everybody okay with that? Interested in that? Maybe is 10 years a long time?
I do have one suggestion.
Yes.
Annexation occurred in 2011, 2012, and so that sort of re-baselines everything. We could look for the past couple of years.
Yeah, but your budget would versus your actual would still be valid.
True. I just think that we could easily go back there and at least have a baseline that's somewhat.
All right, I'll give you that.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
And it's important to understand when new employees are added, there is a minimal amount of training and supplies that are added with each employee. So when as staff has grown, some of those budgets have grown.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Right. I don't even want to ask if you could factor that out.
Not very easily.
the point I'm trying to make is it's easy from a budgeteer's point of view to say, okay, no growth in non-personnel costs. From a department point of view, we're going to operate and we're going to have some, we're going to spend what we need to spend to get that. And usually that's the best investment is giving the tools that you need to your employees to making them satisfied. Mm-hmm. So I think it's counterintuitive that, okay, we're not going to allow any growth, but it actually happens and should happen. I think we ought to recognize it.
Thank you. Any other comments? So maybe that's something you could bring back to us in the budget, the big...
Got it.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Meixel. So I will now open the public hearing. Do we have a sign-in sheet? We do not. Would anyone like to address the council about our proposed revenue sources for the 2017-18 budget? Then the public hearing is closed. Thank you very much. The next item on our agenda is item 10 under unfinished business. It's the utility rates process overview, part 2, city manager.
All right. So thank you, Madam Mayor. So this is part 2 of our 3-part series on utility rates. We gave you kind of a background overview of utility rates at the first meeting. Now we're actually giving you the city manager's preliminary recommendation on the rates would be. What we're looking for is questions and direction at this point, not final action, and then we'll be coming back to you in October with the final rates for your adoption. So we have a few guests here to speak to this, but we're starting off with Deputy City Manager Tracy Dunlap.
Oh, Tracy, it's been a while.
Yes, I told you I wouldn't be back this time, but I have two slides that are follow-ups to the discussion we had last time. So there were two questions that came up that we wanted to try to respond to with the next two slides. And one was I had made the comment that there would be years where we might be paying more to Cascade Water Alliance than the amount of water we were selling because it's a 3-year rolling average and, you know, with weather and all of that. And so we went back to what we had readily available and looked at what our demand share charges were, which is what we pay to Cascade, and what our actual consumption was. And what you can see is the effect of the rolling average to a certain extent. And the interesting thing is that there have been changes in the formula over time, and it's how we change versus how other jurisdictions change, because we're basically distributing a relatively fixed cost. I guess I haven't done water rates for many, many years. They sound like they're a variable rate business, but they're really not. And so This was the best we could come up with to kind of give you a sense of where there were changes in what we were paying for versus what we were consuming. But it was a little hard to normalize out all of that history, because if Sammamish Plateau, for example, was growing leaps and bounds, their share of the demand piece was different than our share of the demand piece. And so we could do a lot more detailed analysis. We would probably need to enlist Cascade into that, because they would have to normalize out some of the factors that we're talking about. And so I think I just wanted to test whether you wanted a lot more information on this, or whether this sort of satisfied the general dynamics. You can see this is kind of a truncated scale here. It doesn't start at zero, so the actual differences in real dollars are not as dramatic, but it's something where we've actually had a crossover between our actual consumption and the demand share. So at the moment, we're selling a little bit more water than we're paying for. So we could do more, but it would be a fairly significant exercise, and I think what we wanted to do is check in with you and see if you wanted a lot more analysis on it. Again, we would need their economists to start factoring some things out of the projections.
What does this say for the future?
Alas, I would say that it is hard to say. I think it really depends a little bit on the weather patterns. It depends. I think their forecasts are fairly consistent in terms of the amount of the rate increase. So our relative cost to our relative revenues are growing at similar rates. And I think, again, what we were trying to do is take an actual in 1 year and compare it to the rolling averages. And that becomes sort of increasingly difficult as well. You know, when we, I think what I would say is that that difference between the two is probably not that significant. Again, this is kind of an exaggerated scale. If you look at the left-hand side, it starts at a million six hundred cubic feet and goes to 2,000,003. And so that 100,000 cubic feet is not dramatic. We could maybe ask them to take a look at that and see how that would normalize. But again, it's one of the things that makes this really hard and would make us have to go there is it's the projection of everyone else's growth versus our growth. And so our in areas where it's growing faster or slower, it changes. And those are sort of the results that you see over time, is that when they do their forward projections, the growth projections have been relatively conservative. I was going to say you've seen more of those. What happens now is much more water is being sold because there's growth and all of that. But then if there's a contraction again, you'll start to see a redistribution of how all of this goes among the partners, essentially. And so I don't know if you want to speak, because you see some of those more detailed projections.
The extended numbers are really very good so far. We have not started with the layer that will be the capital costs that I don't think we're anticipating coming for another 10 years or so. But it might be worthwhile, Tracy, to ask Ed if he's got any of the documents that project us out a little bit further, even just as an organization.
In terms of the dollars themselves, yeah, as opposed, yeah, to the consumption?
Because we've certainly seen that.
Right, and that's kind of what we were trying to unbundle, is the three-year rolling average as it relates to sort of the annual, without having to go back and recreate sort of a historical piece. And right. I think Nancy had some conversations with Cascade, and they could do it, but there would be an effort on their part to do that. So maybe I can see if he has anything readily available of what the Cascade projections look like for us.
Yeah, because right now, I mean, with development at the rate that it is right now, they're getting so many connection fees, and I think they've altered the way that the connection fees, I think the connection fees have been going directly into reserves this whole time to offset what we're going to have to push into capital. Mm-hmm. But there's some documentation out there that might be helpful that Ed could round up for us. Mm-hmm. Suffice it to say, we're on a pretty good track.
Right, and I think just to sort of simplify the relative interpretation of these two lines on the graph, right now we're selling a bit more water than we're paying for, so that would bode well, but I don't know that we would say that that would continue that way, because with the three-year average, we'll start to all normalize a little bit again. And so, like I said, I think we sit fine right now, and I think in the projections, the growth of the cost is fairly moderate well into the future. But that's what I... So I think if that's the direction, we can go and ask them to give us sort of their projections as we relate to the rest of the system, and try to bring that back with the adoption.
I just, the difference, the cost and consumption lines are bearing less and less relationship to one another.
Yeah.
You would think that as consumption comes down, then costs would also come down, but it's like everything else that we deal with. They just don't.
Yeah, that's the realization I was sitting here coming to.
Right.
Consumption almost is insignificant.
Exactly. Having had these discussions for a long time, when you think about what a water system is, most of it is the pipes, the delivery, the treatment, all of that. And so the actual incremental costs and the cost of developing the supply, which is the huge cost, or buying the supply. And so, right, the variable costs of it tend to be actually quite small, and it can be a pretty big dislocation. That's why major droughts or major economic issues will tend to drive water rates way up, because essentially you're absorbing a similar cost over a smaller base.
So the cost drivers from Cascade Water are the real thing that we ought to be looking at, and their cost projections, not at our consumption.
And that is what I think the forecasts that Councilmember Sweet is talking about would show, is it shows what their forecast is and what the costs look like. And really the big variable there is capital. How soon would we need to build another source of supply?
Right. And the way that we're getting at that capital, which right now is pretty fundamental with the development across all of the city, all of the member cities.
I'm having multiple aha moments tonight.
I think we're good on this one.
Thank you.
Okay.
We have a plan.
Thank you. All right. And the other was to talk a little bit more about the capital contingency reserves and how do we know what enough is. And for your reading pleasure, when you get the budget issue papers, there's one in insurance which has a little segment on this that talks about it a little bit more, but this is a few of the high points. Just as kind of a recap, we set a minimum capital contingency balance in each one of the utilities at 10% of the six-year CIP, which can be used toward unanticipated failures. It's basically not programmed in as a CIP project. But that the reserves in general, and this is true of most utilities, are not intended for a major catastrophic event. That's what we would look to the feds for, to be honest, and it's certainly in an earthquake, but even in sort of a sub-regional major storm type of thing, we look to the state and the federal government there. And so the intent of the reserves we have is to either make short-term funding, so something big breaks. I'll use the Totem Lake culvert collapse, if you'll recall, a few years back. And so we look at the money that's there, we put it in, and then to a certain extent, which that's not the greatest example for, we would then replenish those reserves if they went below the target levels with rates. So it lets us raise rates more slowly and more, or I guess less shockingly from a ratepayer standpoint when we respond to an emergency. So that's one way it's used. The other is to bridge it until you can do long-term funding. So if you had a major... I guess a good example would be the tank that's on Rose Hill. That's probably one of the single biggest assets that the utilities have. If something catastrophic happened to that, we wouldn't expect to pay that all out of current funds, but we'd have to do what was necessary to deal with it for the moment and figure out our long-term funding. So if we had to replace it and it was $10 million, we would issue debt, we would pursue grants, we would do a lot of other things. And so the intent of the reserve is to get you from here to there on something major like that. The other thing is, if we had a really big catastrophe in one of the utilities, we would probably reprioritize some of the other capital projects because they're preventative in nature. And we always have the citywide reserves, which are for major unforeseen capital events. And so while we don't first think of those for the utilities, that if the utilities had some sort of a major problem, those are also available to be used there too. The system replacement funding kind of adds more cash to that mixture. We're putting aside the depreciation and the depreciation with a multiplier. And in a way, it's a grand, and we talked about this a little bit more the last time, assessment of sort of overall in the system, how much do we want to be setting aside from current ratepayers versus the burdens in the future. But if you have a failure of a pipe that has just aged outside, the system replaced outside that projection, because we don't do it pipe by pipe, we do it sort of the entire system, that system replacement funding is also available to replace that pipe. So it doesn't have to be an emergency or a big increment. And so the other thing that we talked to the CIP group about is, have we run across anything where the reserves haven't been adequate to a response? And in the years of time that we could poll in that group, we could not think of a time when the reserves were not adequate to meet past needs. They may have required either issuing debt or reprioritizing another capital project, but they never were inadequate from that standpoint. And so I went back and looked at Bellevue's reserve policies, which some unnamed consultant helped them with many years ago, and looked at the same thing. And what they tried to do is something very similar, is to make sure that they build in enough contingency in each project so that the project's not drawing on it, enough to look at what a major failure might do, and then to make sure that they had the contingency in place to be able to respond if it was greater than this could actually absorb, so that they could just bridge themselves. So I think it's fairly similar, but it really is a matter of policy. How much money do you want to idle and take from current ratepayers versus, you know, based on the unknown, essentially. And so we could be more conservative, but it would drive rates. And so I think so far it's served us fairly well, and it's been in place for some time. I think it might be as early as 1990 that these general policies have been in place, not the depreciation funding, but the capital reserves.
Question for you from Mr. Nixon.
I know that in general, general fund and utility funds have to be completely segregated. So in one of these instances where we had to use citywide reserves for an emergency capital project in a utility, is that treated as a loan from the general fund?
It doesn't have to be. It's actually only a one-way door. You can't use utility money for general purposes. You can use general money for anything that's within your governmental purview. And so there are actually utilities, very rarely, but there are utilities where their general government subsidizes the utilities and actually pays the fees. So it's really more of a one-way door because the utilities are managed as enterprises, and so their funds can't move to the general fund except through something like a tax, which is sort of taking it through the front door.
But if we wanted to treat it as
absolutely.
A loan from the general fund to the utility, we could.
You certainly could.
Okay. Thanks.
You certainly could. And we actually have a tendency to do it the other way. We loan money out of the utilities and pay it back, but you could. All right, so those are my two slides.
Any other questions or comments for Tracy? Thank you very much.
Great, and I'm going to turn it over to Nancy Otterholt first, and she's going to talk about the water, sewer, and surface water rates.
Good evening. And then John will finish up with the solid waste rates. We have guiding principles for throughout the utilities, and the rates should fully fund ongoing operations. They should maintain or replenish cash reserves. They should maintain or enhance capital contributions. And we would like regular modest rate increases. And the rate should also reduce or maintain cross subsidies. And we'll talk about each of these a little bit more by utility. So to start with the water utility, the water utility has a budget of about $13.7 million annually. 40% of this goes to Cascade to pay for the purchase of water as well as some of their administrative costs. There's also just the local city services. The capital is the system reinvestment that we'll talk about. We have utility taxes and state taxes making up about 15% of it. And then there's the regional connection charges that we collect on behalf of Cascade, and then we remit that to them. Some rate assumptions used for our proposed 17-18 rate increases. We want to maintain, and in the water case, reduce the cross-subsidy. We have, a couple years ago, used outside consultants to do a cost of service analysis, and that showed that we should be collecting more from residential customers than we currently are. This is not uncommon in utilities, and it's also not uncommon to try and reduce that subsidy over time. The outside consultants suggested a 5 or 6 year period. A little bit of that depends on the rate increases we have each time. But in 15-16, we began the process of trying to reduce the cross subsidies. And so you'll see our proposals for 17-18 again reduce this subsidy, not completely eliminate it, but we're trying to get to the point where we probably have more of a pure cost of service. Another rate assumption
Excuse me, Nancy, we have a question for you.
Question. What's our target date to eliminate the cross subsidy?
Again, that's a little bit difficult with how much rate increase is needed every year. But if we're following and trying to give most of the increase to residential, probably about a 6 year period. So we're on year three right now, 3 and 4.
Okay, thank you.
Cascade Water Alliance. So the another assumption is to pass through the rate increase from Cascade Water Alliance. They're proposing 2.73% in 17 and 2.5% in 18. And for the water utility, this wholesale rate increase pass-through happens to be 100% of our proposed rate increase. Current rates can absorb the increase in system reinvestment and any operating increases, but we do need to pass through the Cascade Water Alliance increase. We increased our system reinvestment. It was 1.2 times depreciation in 16. Our proposal increases it to 1.25 times depreciation for 17 and 18. And if the proposals are adopted, the water utility goal of 1.2 times depreciation will have been reached. So our proposal to, again, reduce the subsidy, we need an average of 1% in 17 and 18 to pass through the Cascade increase. And our proposal is that the single family would get 1.7% increases in 17-18. Multifamily and commercial would not see any increases, and that would get us to our 1% average that we need. And the impact of this to an average customer would be about 84 cents per month in 17 increase, 85 cents in 18. So by the end of 18, we're paying about $1.69 a month more than in 16. This includes the 13.38% utility tax, and that amount ends up in the general fund. It's collected on our utility bills and then sent to the general fund from the utility.
Question for you, Nancy. Mm-hmm. Mr. Asher.
This average customer is the average single family residential customer, right?
That's correct.
I'd like to, in the examples that went on through here, I'd like to see later on in the process if we can also develop the multifamily average.
Okay.
Because we're almost half and half, and so looking at the impacts for both of those, I think, would be informative.
Sure. Okay. Okay, any other questions on water?
Thank you.
Okay, sewer. The sewer budget is about $14.7 million annually. About 57% of this budget goes to King County. Again, there's city services, our system reinvestment into the capital, and taxes of about 10% of the budget. We have very similar rate assumptions that we did in water. We're going to maintain, or in this case, reduce the cross-subsidy. We had a more current cost of service analysis done for sewer this year, and again, it showed similar that we should be collect for a pure cost of service analysis. We should be collecting more from residential. The rate proposals will chip away at that a little bit, not completely eliminate that. And for sewer, we would just be beginning that process for the 17-18 rates. King County has adopted a rate increase of 5.21% for 2017. There will not be a rate increase for 2018.
Question again for you, Nancy. Sorry to interrupt.
That's okay.
Again, on cross-subsidy.
Okay.
When are you targeting?
I would say it would take about the same amount of time, but we're starting a couple years later.
Okay.
So probably 5 to 6 years.
So if we could include that when we're talking about this, so we can
Okay. Sort
of track it.
Okay.
Can I just add a quick comment on that? We're not totally setting a date by which we want to do it. It's really more how big the rate increases are. And so if we could forego rate increases for a year or two, for some reason, it would stretch it out a little longer. But we can give at the current projection how long we think it might take.
Yeah.
Okay.
I saw no target in any of these, and I couldn't tell where we are along the process.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Again, we've said that the King County portion is about 57% of the budget. With the increase of 5.21% for 17, that is about 3% of our proposed rate increases due to the pass-through of King County. Sewer also had an increase in system reinvestment from 1.3 times depreciation in 16, 1.4 in 17, and 1.5 in 18. At this point, if we keep the same rate of increase, our goal is 1.65 times depreciation, and this will be met by 2020. But that can change based on rate increases and so forth. But that's kind of where we're looking at right now, is to be at our goal in 2020. So we have uneven rate increases again because of the subsidy. We're proposing 4.8% for single family, 2.7% multifamily and commercial, and we need 3.9% utility in total for 2017. And 2018, 1.3% single family, multifamily, commercial, 1.4%, needing a total of 1.6%.
Yes, sir. Mr. Asher.
This one I didn't understand. If we're reducing the cross subsidy of multifamily to single family, is that right?
Reducing the subsidy to residential, yeah, from
multifamily,
right,
and commercial. In that case, I would expect the single family to, until we got the point where there was no cross subsidy,
right,
single family increase would be higher than the multifamily increase. But
right,
in the second year, it's lower.
Well, the 2018 is a little difficult because there's zero increase in the King County. And we actually did, so really the only increase you have is the local city increases. And that we did give more to single family, about 5.3%, and about 3% to multifamily commercial. It gets very diluted because it's in a total with King County's and local, and the two together dilute it from like a 5.3% to a 1.3%
It's not the cross subsidy of the rate; it's the total of the revenue. Okay, all right.
Yeah.
Thank you. Uh-huh. I couldn't get to see how that would work.
That was a really great question. I have to say, we spent a bit of time proving that out. Yeah, because it is a peculiarity of the math, I think.
Sorry.
So these proposed rate increases would result in about $3.42 monthly increase to the average customer and $1.63 in 2018 to the average customer, which is about $5.05 end of 18 versus 2016. Shows the 10.5% utility tax in here, which is the same as water, that ends up going to the general fund. That's our sewer. And surface water. We have a $10 million annual budget in surface water. About 68% is city services, system reinvestment and capital. About 8% goes to taxes, and about 1% we pay King County. They do our billing for us on the property tax statements. So about 1% of our budget is to pay them for their services. Rate assumptions are a little bit different. We do have a system reinvestment. It is at one time annual depreciation, and we expect to continue that. We also send $500,000 to fund capital for transportation projects. And we also send to capital from the operating side $262,500, which is to fund the recommendations of the surface water master plan. As you've heard earlier this evening, we updated surface water design requirements. Will increase environmental benefits, but also increase costs and complexity of review, construction, and maintenance. And the update of the critical areas ordinance, the same thing, increased environmental protection, but at increased permitting and construction costs. So all of these assumptions were taken into consideration with our proposed rates. And the proposal is a 2% increase in 17 and 18, which will result in monthly increase of 36 cents in 17, 37 cents in 18, for a total of 73 cents. And there's utility tax included in this as well. It goes to the general fund. Any questions?
Yes, Mr. Asher.
And why does our utility tax vary by utility?
Tracy.
Okay. Once upon a time, they did not vary.
Okay.
And they were all, I believe, 7.5%. They were all the same. And then a couple of things happened. During the downturn, we talked about raising the utility tax, and the council decided to keep the surface water utility tax at 7.5% and just raise water and sewer to 10.5%. I'm not quite sure, and I'll look to Marilyn and see if she remembers the rationale, but there was a desire not to raise the utility tax on surface water, and that's been the same since then.
I think it was new. It was one of the reasons.
I think the idea was that people had more control over how much water they used, so there was more control over how much they would be taxed, whereas surface water is a flat rate for residential.
Makes sense.
Oh, that's a good one, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Perfect. Yeah. But then the second one is, why is the water now 13.38%, such a nice odd number? You might recall a few years back we talked about hydrants, and there was a ruling of hydrants and that you needed to pay for hydrants from the general fund. And so the council took action at that time to pay for the hydrants from the general fund, but then the utility tax was raised to make that up, a very common approach that cities use to deal with that. And so that is why there are three different rates for the three different utilities.
It doesn't have to remain that way, but it
was... And that takes care of my hydrant question later on.
There's your hydrant question.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tracy.
Jeez.
I think we're ready to go forward.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you, Nancy.
Appreciate it.
Good evening, Mayor Wallen and City Council members. I start off with a beautiful picture of a pile of garbage at our Cedar Hills landfill. So in terms of our solid waste budget, it's about $17.2 million. It's important to point out that about three-quarters of that are payments to waste management. The rest is in taxes, city services about 8%, and then there's a 2% street preservation fee that we pay to the CIP to deal with the wear and tear that our trucks make on our streets. That's about $300,000. And so the kicking this off, it's important to note at this point, the King County Executive has transmitted a proposed rate to the King County Council. It's about a 15% rate increase from 120 to about 137. It's been in committee for the last month. It has not gone out of committee. And so the King County Council needs to take action by September 30th and adopt a rate. And so we're kind of held hostage a little bit. And so I just want to point out that the numbers that we all be presenting tonight are not probably not accurate. They're looking at, there was some sticker shock on the part of the council members. The 15% was pretty high, and so they're looking to reduce that. So our numbers may come down a little bit. So I just wanted to point that out. Another assumption that we have is the CPIW, which is the Seattle, Bremerton, and Tacoma wage earners.
John, can I interrupt?
Yes.
Just with regard to that rate change, we haven't changed the rate, or we haven't increased it since 13. Is that correct?
We've actually updated our rates.
Ours, but King County.
Yeah, King County. It's been 4 years since they've adopted a new rate. That's correct. And one of the drivers in our rates is the CPI that is granted to waste management. That's a contractual requirement on our part. It's 1.99% for 2017, and we've estimated about 2.5% for 2018. As you'll recall, one of the major things we wanted to accomplish in this rate period was replenishing our cash reserve. It got dangerously low after annexation, down to about $500,000, and we wanted to bring it back up to $1.3 million, and that's based upon 1 month of payments to waste management plus expenses. Since we bill our customers every 2 months, but we pay them monthly, so we need to have that cash balance. We've achieved that, so we're not asking to increase that anymore. We just want to hold it as is. We currently have re-achieved our steady but stable rate of downsizing. If you recall, in 2009, we had a huge spike when we went full linear, and in 2011 at annexation, we had a huge, even a bigger spike because the folks up there had a cost of service model, and they took full advantage of our linear rates and did a lot of downsizing. One of the other assumptions is to maintain or reduce the cross-subsidy, as Nancy had talked about. In 2013-14, we had about a $390,000 cross-subsidy. This period, we've brought it down to $290,000, and in this proposed rate period, we're looking at about $235,000. So we're gradually chipping away at it. And to Councilmember Asher's question that you've asked, there's no specific timeline. Again, it's more of an opportunistic thing that we would be trying to lower that. So if there's an opportunity in the future where the rate increases are lower, we might take full advantage and perhaps level it out to full cost of service.
I'd suggest we pick a number and try to work toward it, though.
Yeah. And we've been chipping away at it. And so, and then again, maintaining the nearly linear rate structure. This has really served us well over the years. It's helped us maintain a high diversion rate. It helped us get to the 70% in single family. It's just about one tool that we have, and it's a great tool, but it's not the be all end all. I would refer to it as a analogy as a finely tuned engine. You don't want to over tune it. You want to under tune it. But right now we're actually about as tuned as we can get with this thing because the downsizing is stabilized. So in terms of the proposed rates, we're looking at proposing a 5.4% increase in 2017. No increase for multifamily commercial, and again, we're getting to that cross-subsidy, eliminating that. Roll-off is pure cost of service at this point. We eliminated that cross-subsidy. And for 17, we're looking, proposing a 3%. In 2018, we're proposing a 1.9% increase. And you can see in the table at the bottom that in terms of by the end of 18, we're proposing about a $2.25 increase to the average customer with a 35-gallon cart. That's how much they'd be paying at the end of 2018, more than they are right now.
Mr. Asher.
Thank you. On the roll-off being cost of service, is that the cost that Waste Management charges us, or our cost with direct costs allocated to that?
Yeah, there's really three different parts of roll-off. Okay. One is the rental of the container. The one is the hauling of the container. And on those two, we actually have a margin that we charge over that wholesale rate, the retail rate.
Okay.
And they pay their share of the allocated costs across. Okay. And then you have the disposal. And that is essentially a pass-through. We have granted Waste Management a 15% markup on that tonnage to pay for administrative costs of, you know, the billing costs associated with that. But so that's how.
So that's taking care of our admin there.
Yes.
Okay. Good to go.
So that extra 15% is our admin?
That is charged directly to the customer. They pay that.
And it goes to us, not to Waste Management, or to.
It goes to Waste Management.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. It goes to Waste Management. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Their rate. Yeah.
I just interrupted. It's Mr. Nixon's turn.
If we were to succeed in increasing diversion rates for multifamily and commercial, would that have a significant impact on the structure? I mean, would we have to revise rates to account for less revenue from garbage as opposed to, you know what I'm getting at, right?
I do. You know, the linear rates are really most effective in the single family sector. Multifamily and commercial, oftentimes they have what they have and they produce what they produce, and so their opportunities to take advantage of the linear rates are less. And so the impact of that, I think, is, you know, probably would be less than, to get to your point, I guess. Does that answer your question, or maybe not?
So in other words, not to worry.
Not to worry.
We can go ahead with deliberate effort to increase diversion rates and not have to worry about how it's going to impact the utility from a financial perspective.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And here is the proposed utility rates in summary. I just wanted to point to the numbers at the bottom. For all of the rates combined, we're asking for another $6.04 per month, an impact to the average customers. You can see on the left what we define an average customer as. And then for 2018, $3.66 more. And so in summary, a monthly increase by the end of 2018 of about $10 more, and then an annual increase of about $116 more to the average customer. And this is just shows the comparison graphically between the different utilities. It's the same information, but you can see how the increases play out there.
Mr. Asher.
Thank you. Before we get too far away from solid waste discussion, the multifamily recycling is abysmal everywhere, or almost everywhere, I guess. I'd like to see us include a budget item for a program to make multifamily recycling better. So it just takes and directly budget something in the rates and in our costs to improve multifamily recycling. I think that will get us that'll give us a program that we have to, in fact, do something deliberately to get that done. And I'd be willing to go across the country to see who's doing better than what we're doing, and let's go find out what the secret is. But I think we really need to attack that. This is a good biennium to do that with. We're on an upturn, and we're going to be growing multifamily even more. We're going to get back to half
of our residents' occupancy is going to be in multifamily. So if we could, I think that might work for us, and I'd love to see the staff propose something like that.
Well, I appreciate that, but I do want to just point out that I have happened to have two of the greatest staff members that work for me in the world, I think, and so the inroads that they've made in multifamily in the last couple of years are pretty amazing, in my view. We're still lagging behind single family pretty significantly. So if you take the yard waste out, let's just take that out of the single family, you're talking about a 42% diversion rate for single family. Right now we're about 22% for multifamily, which when I started in 2007, we were about 13 or 14%. So we're making some incremental increases, but what we're doing, we're pretty proud of right now. But you're absolutely right. There's more to do. There's a lot more to do. Yeah. And so,
remember when we did the plastic bag ban and John's top 10 list?
Yeah.
Plastic bag ban wasn't even maybe on there, but number one was this issue. And I thought we had talked about doing something like this. I don't know if you have something in the works, but I definitely agree with that. And I'm wondering, because we have so much multifamily coming on with these new projects, are they situated, have we done everything we can to make sure that when new projects come online, mm-hmm. that we're good? We're good. Okay.
Yeah, and that's a really good point. We're heavily involved in the review, the plan review of these new developments coming in so that we can optimize their opportunities on site. You've probably seen some of these older buildings that there's just literally nothing there. And so we've had the opportunity.
No place to put anything.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so we're really enforcing our guidelines on you have to provide the space for these containers and as well as food scrap recycling and making sure that it's convenient for the customers. But does that solve the problem? No, it doesn't. There's a lot of education outreach and behavior change too.
Just in addition to that, I mean, I think it's Toby and I went on a tour of the recycling plant that Waste Management runs up in Snohomish?
Woodinville.
And we're not doing that good a job. When you get into there and you see the amount of garbage that is there and the bales, literally the size of that box of plastic bags that they pull out of the recycling, it really is amazing. So I think our numbers are pretty amazing, but we still have a lot of work to do just educating people to get plastic bags out of recycling. So there's a lot of work to do, and I agree with you. Your staff people are fabulous and doing a fabulous job with the multifamily, but we got a lot more work to do across the board.
And if we budget something, maybe you get another staff member. I don't know what the solution is, but it just... there's a there that we need to attack.
Mr. Triplett.
So, just want to make sure I capture this. What I'm hearing is bring back an option with the final rates that says, here's a solid waste increment the council could choose to add if you wanted to make an investment in multifamily recycling. Would you like to see that option brought back with the final
rates? And we'd add it to multifamily rates. You can isolate this one to multifamily rates. Because that's where the problem is.
So would you
maybe
like to see some options?
Exactly. Some thinking around that and bring us back options.
So bring back the rate that you saw today plus maybe one or two options for what a multifamily rate option would look like. And then you could add it to it if you so choose.
Yeah, but don't we suspect that the rate we're going to get back is a little less than what we're once we get the solid numbers from King County.
Oh, yeah.
So maybe there's some wiggle room in there.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So we'll bring those back.
Thank you.
Super. I would like, again, before we lose get away too far from solid waste, I'd like to see our solid waste, our recycling for single family and multifamily, and if you want to break out yard waste in there too, that's fine. Let's give us some history on that. I want to see where that's gone. I do not share. The linear rate model is, to me, a disincentive for recycling, so I want you to show me how it's helping recycling.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments? Thank you very much, John.
And finally, just in terms of some next steps, on October 4th, we're expecting to come back with the water, sewer, and surface water rate ordinances. I'm concerned that we're not going to be able to make the October 4th meeting with the solid waste rate, since King County has not adopted those yet, and so we may have to return to you on the 18th with that particular set of rates.
That's our drop dead
for our notification to our customers. Yes, and that concludes my remarks. Any other questions?
I think we're okay. Thank you very much, Sean.
Thank you.
So I think we should stop for a 10-minute break. Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Let's have a break. Thank you very much. Welcome back. We are back for item number 11 on our agenda under new business. It's the Transportation Commission mission statement and 2016-17 work plan. City Manager.
All right. Thank you, Madam Mayor. So this is checking back in with you after the April meeting that you had, the joint meeting you had with the Transportation Commission, and we're here to provide you with their updated mission statement and an adoption of the 2016-17 Transportation Commission Work Program. So here to make the presentation is our Transportation Manager, Joel Funt.
Welcome, Joel. I think this is the first time that you've given a presentation to
yes,
me.
Yes, I believe it is.
Welcome.
Absolutely. That's right.
Lovely to see
not
you
an
here.
Appointed commissioner.
Isn't this a fantastic council?
Yes, it is. It is. You're a good-looking group, so I'm happy to be here.
Compared to your former
it's a great
board.
Team, isn't it? We're very glad you're
no
here,
no comment.
Joel.
So. Okay. So what I'm going to be doing this evening, so I'm here as the City Transportation Manager, but also as staff of the Kirkland Transportation Commission. And so I'm going to just give a quick background of how we got here, review the updated mission statement and the 2016-2017 work plan. And then we are recommending, staff is recommending approval of the ordinance for the updated mission statement and then the resolution to approve the 16-17 work plan. So as way of background, back in March of this year, Commissioner Neer came and presented a proposed mission statement and work plan to council, and out of that there was a request for a joint study session, and in April the council and the commission got together for that joint study session. And based on the feedback from that meeting in May and June, the commission worked to integrate that into those two documents. So when it came to the feedback from the study session, I'm going to start with the mission statement. And there were a few key things that came out of there. First, the mission statement should reflect the advisory role of the commission. The development of the work plan in consultation with the council, and then approval of the work plan by city council. And so to kind of show how that worked, this is actually the mission statement that was presented basically at the April 19th joint study session. But then what I've done is added in here the text that's been edited since then. And that first one reflects the advisory role that the commission plays, that the commission advises the Public Works Department, city manager, and city council in effort of leading the city's efforts in transportation. Then the next one was the work plan and the idea of establishing the annual work plan. And then the third edit was that the council and the city council and the commission would meet to discuss the annual work plan for adoption by the city council.
Question
for you, Joel.
Our
Mr. Asher.
Comment on this. I will propose an amendment to this to say we'll meet at least annually, so that we don't have to change an ordinance to meet a second time if we want to.
Good point. Okay. Thank you. And so with that, I'll move on to the work plan. And at that same joint study session, council had some comments on the formatting of the work plan, and it's been significantly revised to be more of a standard kind of Gantt chart work plan format. Council asked to remove parking from the commission's work plan, and then to add the annual update of the work plan to make sure that that was reflected in there. Since then, there's been a couple of other modifications. 405 hot lanes was a standalone item, and that was removed. And this idea of measuring progress towards goals, that was actually just folded into the item transportation master plan implementation. That's where that would take place, and the monitoring of that would take place in that. And then, of course, the work plan is tied into, you know, the overarching theme is implementation of the recently adopted transportation master plan. And then there's a sample of the format there at the bottom with a legend and those types of things.
Mr. Asher.
Thank you. On your legislative advocacy, I think you need to include time prior to, at least during election years, prior to the end of the year, and in the third quarter, and during the first parts of the year, first and or second quarter. Probably first quarter for working with changes to legislation as they occur, and that would be being involved with the legislative work group of the council. On the Metro Long Range Plan, there's an active opportunity for active participation prior to its implementation, rather than on the work plan it indicates waiting for the implementation to occur. I think there's opportunity even now to participate in the development of Metro's planning documents and in their service guidelines on a recurring basis. So that I think might be an opportunity that the Transportation Commission would want to look at in accomplishing. I was concerned to see Vision Zero, which is listed as number 25 here, as a future work plan item, because it's an integral part of the TMP and a key part of the Transportation Master Plan. So I don't think that it doesn't reflect my understanding of how Vision Zero fits into our Transportation Master Plan. That was a key thing that I took away. And when you get up to looking at the Transportation Master Plan, you have rolled in the measures, and I think that those are absolutely critical. I hope to see you working with the Public Works, Parks and Human Services Committee on those, because that to me is where you're going to make your money. An additional thing that I didn't see that I'd like to see how we can come up with is to develop a transit plan, not just a transit study, but a transit plan. Because in our master plan, we, in fact, provide a mode split. We assume in our comprehensive plan a mode split for our transportation system to work. We can break that down to trips and to service levels that we are going to need out of Metro and Sound Transit. And I think we can measure whether they're measuring up, and we can go and advocate directly with them over the long term to get that. So I'd like to see us get more into the specifics. And if we can't include it on this year's work plan, maybe we can get it into next year's work plan after the transit study.
Yeah, when it comes to the work items in 2017, the transit study and the active transportation plan, both of those items are really intended to be, you know, produce plans that are, you know, specific action items that were called for in the TMP that would develop plans that would kind of bring the transportation master plan to that next level that would be implementable items. And cool. So yeah, that's part of the goal there.
Thank you.
So are you comfortable going forward tonight then?
Yes, I am. Okay. I think that there's some emphasis areas that I hope to see them do, mm-hmm. but I don't see that it would keep us from approving this tonight.
Okay. So maybe you could incorporate those comments and pass them on. I don't think any council members have any heartburn with any of those. Mr. Arnold.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. When we first looked at this work plan earlier this year, there was some enthusiasm from some transportation commission members on advanced technology. And while the work plan we've got, we're not asking them for any policy work yet on autonomous vehicles or anything like that, I do want to make sure our commissioners are engaged in this. We've mentioned ETP at previous council meetings. We mentioned that ETP is organizing an advanced technology advanced transportation technology symposium in December, and I'd like to check into whether we can offer transportation commissioners a chance to attend that if they wish.
Okay.
Good idea.
Thank you.
Yeah, Queen, for a day, if I could, I would have us design a loop of around Kirkland, you know, Carillon Point to downtown to Google around, and partner with Google and try the driverless vehicles. I mean, it would be fun to be at the forefront of that. And
well,
I think that's
getting right away to do that.
Municipalities need to design these loops, I think, for, you know, getting away from the idea of driverless cars is just a lot more cars with no drivers, but that they're actually transit service. Anyway, I think that's the great opportunity. Okay. Other comments?
That's a capital project. Madam Mayor?
Yes, sir.
I'd like to move Ordinance 4531, updating the powers and duties of the Transportation Commission.
Second.
Thank you. It's been moved by Councilmember Asher, seconded by Deputy Mayor Arnold to approve Ordinance 4531. Is there a discussion? Mr. Asher.
Madam Mayor, I move to amend the draft Ordinance 4531 to insert on line 16, after the word meet, two words, at least.
Second. Thank you. It's been moved by Councilmember Asher, seconded by Councilmember Kloba to amend draft ordinance 4531 to insert on line 16 after the word meet the words at least. So it reads at least annually. Any discussion? Will all those in favor please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Thank you very much. That motion is approved. Now the question is on the main motion. It was moved by Councilmember Asher, seconded by Deputy Mayor Arnold, to approve Ordinance 4531 as amended. It is an ordinance, so I'll ask Ms. Anderson. Oh, unless there's discussion. Ms. Anderson, the roll, please.
Councilmember Nixon.
Aye.
Councilmember Kloba.
Aye.
Councilmember Asher.
Fresh from Scotland, aye.
Councilmember Sweet.
Yes.
Deputy Mayor Arnold.
Aye.
Mayor Wallen.
Aye. Thank you very much. Ordinance 4531 is approved. Mr. Asher?
Madam Mayor, I'd like to move Resolution 5207 pertaining to the adoption of the 2016-2007 Transportation Commission Work Plan.
Second.
Thank you. It's been moved by Councilmember Asher and seconded by Councilmember Sweet to approve Resolution 5207. Is there discussion? Well, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
And those opposed, say no. Thank you. Resolution 5207 is approved, Ms. Anderson. Mm-hmm. All right. The next item on our agenda is Resolution 5208. Amending the timeline of Resolution 5607 relating to planning and land use. Basically, it's about the Houghton Everest Neighborhood Center citizen amendment requests. City Manager.
Okay. Just like to put out for the record that Joel is now undefeated so far at Kirkland. 2-0. Can't say
Thank
the same
you,
about
Joel.
The Mariners tonight. But thank you, Madam Mayor. The item in front of you is a request to extend the deadline by which the Planning Commission would make recommendations to the Council on the Houghton Everest area. And Angela Ruggieri, our senior planner, is here if you'd like a presentation.
Thank you. I think we may not need that. Mr. Asher.
Madam Mayor, I'd like to move Resolution 5208, amending the timeline of Resolution 5607 and accepting the recommendation of the Kirkland Planning Commission to defer action on the Houghton Everest Neighborhood Center Citizens Amendment requests.
Second.
Thank you. Moved by Councilmember Asher, seconded by Deputy Mayor Arnold to approve resolution 5208. Discussion? Well, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
And those opposed, say no. Thank you. Resolution 5208 is approved.
Thank you.
And we're going to move right along to item 12, reports. City Council reports. Mr. Nixon.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Just a couple of things. On September 7th, several of us attended the Sound Cities Association networking dinner at which our former Mayor Joan McBride, current state representative, received the AWC City Champion Award for 2016. So that was a fun evening. On September 8th, Councilmember Sweet and I represented the council at the PTSA Back to School Night at John Muir Elementary, and we missed Councilmember Asher.
Sorry, you couldn't be there.
Yeah, you were busy. And it went very well. We had many opportunities to chat with people in the community and passed out a lot of police pens. And then on September 14th was the Sound Cities Association Public Issues Committee meeting. You received a packet in email. I was not able to attend because of business travel, and Councilmember Kloba represented the city that night.
All right. Well, and I think I will pick right up there.
Thank you.
If you do not mind. So I think that I do owe you all a report, but I think that one thing I wanted to pull out of that is that the Finance Committee for the PIC is now looking at and scrutinizing the King County Executive's budget proposal. And obviously they're going through the same process we are now. They will have a pre-PIC meeting taking a look at it and their analysis for the October pre-PIC, which I think is the 12th, if that sounds right. Yeah, I think that's all that I had from there. On the 7th, the All Home Coordinating Committee met, and it was a longish meeting. We received the System-Wide Analytics and Projection, also known as SWAP, study that had been done by a group called Focus Strategies, and I've sent you a link to it. It's somewhat lengthy, but I think it is well worth diving into because I think the main takeaway was that we've had a great number of wonderful organizations providing services to folks without homes, roofs over their heads right now. And in order to really maximize the investments that we're making there to make sure that we're getting as many people housed as possible, which is our ultimate goal, and to do that with the money that we have available, there has to be a real systemic focus and not sort of the piecemeal that we've done. And this consultant really looked at ways that coordinated entry could help and better utilize the resources that we have now. So it's a little bit of a shifting of the ground underneath our feet, and I would really appreciate you looking at it with sort of in the back of your minds the idea of as we plan our our emergency shelter for women, there may need to be some flexibility that we plan into that if this reshuffling of resources works. We will have less need for emergency shelter and more need for longer term. So I just want you to be able to take a look at that. Domestic Violence Initiative, they put on a wonderful symposium every year, and it draws guest lecturers from around the country. It's really, really wonderful. I unfortunately didn't have time to attend any of the various classes, but we did have our Domestic Violence Initiative meeting, and I think the high point was that there is some real progress being made with the process of surrendering weapons at your first court appearance with the variety of domestic violence protection orders that apply. And this is a much more safer, this is a better efficient, better way to do it, and particularly because there is a heightened risk
of further injury to a former victim in that space soon after the initial domestic violence incident. So it's really about harm reduction and efficiency. So that's good news. And then the Board of Health passed a resolution about, passed unanimously, it was a resolution in support of a campaign to educate parents about the long-term risks of human papillomavirus, HPV, and convey the benefits of the vaccine. And two statistics that I thought were really interesting. The CDC says 30,700 new cancer cases are diagnosed every year in this country, and one in four people are infected with at least one type of HPV, which can cause cancer. We have a vaccine that is making a big dent in preventing cancer. That's huge. This is part of the moonshot, I think, that we're really going to see. So that was wonderful. The Salmon Recovery Council, it's a blur to me when all of these were. I can't tell you what the date it was. There was a lot. They chose their legislative agenda, and primarily it's capital funding requests at the state level, and then some support of some multiple benefit projects that address salmon habitat and water quality and stormwater and floodwater management. So you're kind of getting a lot of bang for the buck. I think that was their main decision point that they were making, and I think that's all that I have for you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Asher.
I'd like to pick up a ball that I dropped, if I could, with the council's indulgence. It flew by me on the consent calendar of a topic that I think this council would like to jump on. It has to do with the 505 Market Street building. I would like to see us take the clearly remaining profit above what we've got budgeted and our broker's commission and dedicate that for the purchase of affordable housing in 2017. I just think it's found money. We haven't included it in our budget projections, and this gives us a way of funding a goose egg that we've had on a council work program priority that probably won't do the whole thing, but it's a big step forward. So,
you mean doing that in the form of a motion?
Yes, I would move that we take the clearly remaining profit from 505 Market Street sale and commit it to the purchase of affordable housing in 2017.
Second.
Thank you. It's moved by Councilmember Asher and seconded by Councilmember Sweet to take the clearly remaining profit from the sale of 505 Market and dedicate it to affordable housing. Discussion, Mr. Arnold.
Well, I think that this is a great idea to consider. I'm a little concerned with moving so quickly on this, and I would like to move amending the motion to ask the city manager to come back with options on ways that we can dedicate this funding. Affordable housing is one potential idea, but we also have fire station construction costs and work on things like the Cross Kirkland Corridor elevator that we're running into cost issues with, and I'd like to have a deliberate discussion of what to do with this particular found money.
So your motion is to...
My motion is to amend this...
Motion is to table the motion.
My motion is to direct the city manager to bring us options at the next meeting for directing this
money. Your motion is to table.
Uh-oh. Parliamentarian in the House? Well, maybe it fails for lack of a second, Mr.
No, it's been second.
No, I
seconded. Excuse me, my
motion. Oh, you did. No, did you second Mr. Arnold's?
No.
No. Okay, great. Sorry. But I think it'll be easier. Help me. I need help here. Mr. Nixon, then Ms. Clova.
So in terms of where we are parliamentary, we're still discussing the main motion.
Yes.
So I support the idea, but I wonder if it needs to be more specific because, you know, I'm interested in directing the funding to the women's shelter, mm-hmm. that, which is what the, I think, the most pressing affordable housing project is that we have, that we're considering. And so I'm really just laying the question out there. Do we want to make it specific to that, or do you want to leave it as broad as you suggested?
On the fly, why don't we leave it broad?
City manager wants to help us, I think.
I was actually going to follow up on that and also just highlight. So we do have the 2017 to 22 CIP update for final adoption, or update coming to the council on the 18th, where you actually get to see all of the potential capital projects, and you could make a decision in that context. If you want options about this money at that same time, we could specifically call it out so you'd have the whole list and then specific ways you might want to spend this money. But I did want to highlight that in the current work program, we identify the women's shelter as one of our priorities, and while we're working on the feasibility study with our partners, we know there's going to be a financial gap that ARCH is not going to be able to fund by itself, and so that would certainly be one place you might want to call out the money instead of just generically. But so my recommendation, I think, would be to have me bring back some options at that 18th meeting, so a separate dedicated slide and discussion, but also in the context of all of it, so the council can see everything else that's out there, and if there's something else that may grab your attention, you see the context of the capital projects.
Will this money be highlighted?
We will absolutely highlight it. It won't go anywhere in the meantime. It will just fall to the bottom into the building and property reserve, and it can be moved out to anything the council wants to use it for. So we can specifically highlight this as part of the presentation and give options.
Will this change any other numbers in for affordable housing that you will have in that presentation?
No, there's not currently anything budgeted, so we would.
Okay.
Right, but that's not the final action on the CIP. It's the discussion, so you can still make changes. So that this would be the right time, I think, to have that conversation in that context, and then we'd bring it back for action in December with the rest of the CIP.
Okay. And now is a more appropriate time for Deputy Mayor Arnold to move to table the motion.
So,
Ms. Clova?
So, and I think we're all sort of getting there, but while I support, absolutely, I'm very excited about this idea of having this money to spend on something that is such, it's a priority for this council, and it is a priority for our community. I hear it out there all the time. My only concern is, that's a very, you know, affordable housing, that's a very amorphous thing, and I'm worried that there's not enough specificity of exactly how would we spend it. And again, given this swap study, making sure that when we spend it, it's going to be in the greater context of how, and honestly, how homelessness is approached in this region for the next 5 to 10 years, because I think we're really seeing a shift. And I just want to make sure that we're going to spend it in the best possible way. So I think I'm really liking this idea of here are some options. It was a little concerning to me that it was just sort of big and amorphous, but if we can focus on some stuff, I'd be in favor of that.
Madam Mayor, I move to table the motion for our next meeting.
Second.
Okay, it's been moved by Deputy Mayor Arnold and seconded by Councilmember Asher, I believe, to table the motion. All those in favor, please say aye. Do we need to say
aye?
We need to vote aye. Thank you. Those opposed? Thank you very much. Motion is tabled. All right.
Well, sounding good at the moment.
So, for other reports, Mr. Asher. Excellent.
Mr. Jetlag.
Nothing other than the... The Parliament of Scotland sends its regards.
Love that. Ms. Sweet.
Oh, yeah. Me next. Okay. Well, as I mentioned at our last meeting, there were some changes made in the scope of the demand management studies, which were to guide the decision on the new Northeast Station or not. And as a result of the last MISWAC meeting, which sort of fell apart in terms of just the whole group, everybody's up in the air about where it is. A direct question to the director of Solid Waste about whether or not this meant that Houghton would be closed for the demand management study elicited no response. So we're kind of back to the to the drawing board. And what I talked to the city manager about today is I'd like to ask John to come give us a briefing about where we are, bring us all back up to speed in terms of the solid waste transfer plan, including the demand management studies, including the discussion of Houghton, its future, just to clarify where we stand. Letters are starting to come. Actually, I'm happy to share them with you from both Gene Garber at SWAC, who is wanting to partner with MSWAC, as MSWAC is the electeds and SWAC is the official body, to come together with something that will work. The SWAC position is that there should be a new Northeast station, and that there's deep question about the science that was used to decide that there shouldn't be a new Northeast station. So anyway, it's all over the board. So I'm hoping you guys will support going ahead with a briefing next council meeting.
As long as they don't take closure.
There you go. Okay. Great. Then I also went to EMAC this month. We had a review of the Cascade Rising outcomes. For the most part, Cascade Rising, I think I mentioned to you, was not a highly successful event. It demonstrated some serious flaws in our communication systems. I actually had left Jay that morning. He asked me to ask some questions about airlift, and the response that we got was that, you know, airlift prefers to use the state system rather than PCERN for communication. This was also a PCERN discussion. So that was just trying to follow up on what you asked. But overall, what we're hoping to do is all of the lessons that we've got from Cascade Rising demonstrate that we've got a number of areas that we need to focus on more about sort of the mechanics of communication, how to manage resources, that kind of stuff. The individual pods of like mass care and those kinds of things, everything worked kind of fine, but coordinating out of all of it, it did not work at all. Anyway, so, yeah.
But the exercise was a booming success then, by identifying.
Well, exactly. You're exactly right.
Yeah.
I think there was a whole lot more hope that the communication systems would work a little bit better, but the chain of command just, it didn't work. And it's a learning, and we're hoping to take some of the dollars that we get with 2017 to help develop that a little bit more. Regional water quality meeting this year, we talked about the Ship Canal project with Seattle and King County for the sewer overflow project. That project is coming in for a change, kind of on budget, which has not been the experience of these projects in the past, and they're moving. It's an amazing project with a, you know, I can't even tell you how long, but it's like 1,400 foot long retention thing. How big is it, Kathy? Do you know? It's absolutely gigantic what they're doing underground in order to support the overflow.
Another tunnel?
It's not a tunnel. It's it's one of those things that we're going to put in single family or whatever.
It's giant. It's a giant holding tank.
Yeah. We also got the capital projects update, which is going to come. We're going to get more data on that the next meeting. Let's see. Chamber Public Affairs meeting was just on Monday. I mentioned that we had a discussion about the head tax increase. The other thing that we talked about is that on Thursday, there's a meeting called Communities Working Together to Embrace Growth. This is going to be at Lake Washington Institute of Technology. Claudia Balducci, Larry Springer, Jay Arnold, Dan McKinney from the Transpo Group. I think it's going to be a panel on just sort of a lot of topics around growth, starting at 7:45 on Thursday for anybody who is interested. And that's about it.
Thank you. Mr. Arnold.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. On September 9th, the Eastside Rail Corridor Regional Advisory Council met. This was the last meeting that Deb Eddy will be staffing for the RAC. Deb Eddy has been appointed by the governor to a seat on the Growth Management Hearings Board. But as she left, she delivered some recommendations for continuing the RAC forward, and there was big support among the discussion for continuing the transportation and connectivity vision of the RAC with an expanded group, not just owners, but also look at adjacent landowners and nonprofit groups. The Eastside Greenway Alliance that we've mentioned before has been a great contributor to the RAC as an invited guest, and they're looking to formalize this to involve Bellevue, Renton, in addition to Kirkland, King County, Sound Transit, Puget Sound Energy, and Woodville on the RAC. There will be a small work group discussion of city managers and mayors to hammer out a updated agreement that we probably will see by the end of the year. Also, on September 14th, I represented the council at the police promotion ceremony. There were several corporals and a sergeant promoted and awards given, and it's always a very moving time to hear the stories. We are so fortunate with our amazing police force, given hearing their stories, where they came from, the experience they bring. It's always a very moving experience to attend those ceremonies. Thank you.
Thank you. So I attended an AWC legislative work group and also the council's subcommittee on the legislative priorities, and we're going to be bringing forward a draft of our legislative agenda, trying to get a jump start on it again. The themes that at least the draft will incorporate are the themes that we heard at AWC, are the things that we heard from the Office of Financial Management, which is we're dealing with McCleary, old paradigms of public works trust fund, shared liquor revenue, the sort of same old legislative agenda that the AWC has been working on for so long. All of those are gone, and they're looking for creative solutions from cities and partnerships. And so what I heard was and that legislative work group, the AWC is relying on that group to give the hard news to the board members because, you know, it's such a diverse board. But there's some just stalwarts on. We've got to have the same things that we've always asked for. And the advice we were given by lobbyists and by the staff, the professional staff there, was just be laser focused, pick your three top things and focus on those and don't make them money, and you'll have much more chance of success. Mm-hmm. So that's the shorthand version of that. I attended the home tour, the first year of the home tour in Kirkland, which was a fundraiser for Kirkland Performance Center and the Heritage Society, and was absolutely lovely, spearheaded by Sue Contreras. And I also attended the Attain Housing event, which was great. And I believe you were there, Mr. Nixon, I think. It's a long time ago. Mm-hmm. But the most moving thing I did was attend Councilmember Sweet led a community effort on the 15th anniversary of September 11th to display flags around the downtown and around our fire stations to honor first responders, and it was very beautiful. And I thank you. It was amazing. So that's my report, and I'm going to move on to the city manager's report.
Okay, thank you, Mayor. So just one major topic, which is I think I mentioned to all that I'd gone to a seminar that was done in Renton by a gentleman named Peter Kagiyama, who has written several books. One is most famous is For Love of Cities, and his whole concept is to find ways to help your citizens fall in love with your city all over again. And so he said that the goal is that the government should find ways to surprise and delight the residents. And when's the last time you got to sit down and figure out ways you can surprise and delight residents? So I've talked to some of you, and we also had a conversation with Can, because we've been looking for ways to re-engage CAN and get more people active, and the neighborhood safety projects have worked really well, but they wanted to see if we could go beyond that. So we kind of came together around Peter, and we've managed to secure him to actually come out on January 9th for a neighborhood summit that we're going to put together. So still details to be worked out, but we're going to have him come out and set up a big summit at KPC in January, have him make a presentation. We'll probably also try to build some smaller focus presentations around maybe our boards and commissions and the council. But so very preliminary, but a really nice partnership with CAN. The two co-chairs are working hard on it, as is Kari Page, so we're pretty excited about that. So stay tuned for more details, but I want to just get that on your radar screen. I have...
Daytime
back
or evening?
I'm sorry?
Daytime or evening?
It's going to be evening. The main one will be evening, but he'll be here for a couple days, so we're still going to work out some of the rest of the schedule. But we have the KPC for the evening of January 9th, and that'll be sort of the big neighborhood summit. So one example when I came back that we were able to create here was the sprinkler. Those of you who got a chance to see it was the sort of sprinkler park in the baseball fields, which ended up being really fun and wildly successful. And so those are the kinds of events and things that he sort of sparks the thinking of in the communities. And it's very focused on getting the residents involved and not having government tell people what to do, but government actually getting out of the way and empowering residents to help create the community that they want. So I think it'll be a great thing for us and for the neighborhood leaders. So on the calendar update, I have the transfer station update to come back on October 4th. And I want to remind everybody we have the All-City Dinner this Thursday, September 22nd. But were there any other changes to the council calendar that the council had?
Mr. Nixon.
Yeah, a couple of things. Councilmember Kloba and I attended the Left One Disability Board meeting this afternoon, and the representatives of police and fire retirees expressed to us continuing concern about the proposal in the legislature to merge the Left One and teachers' retirement systems and the potential impact that that could have on our own retirees and the city's costs potentially. And we discussed and decided to recommend or ask if this issue could be referred to possibly the legislative committee would be the best place to go, and that it be considered for the city's legislative priorities to take a position on this issue. It's a complicated issue. And, you know, so there probably would need to be some staff work to determine what the actual potential impacts are on the city and on our retirees. But it is an area of concern, so we wanted to raise that proposal.
Has there been legislation drafted?
There has been. I don't know if it's a separate bill or if it was like a proviso in the budget or whatever, but I'm sure we can find out from our legislators where it stands. Mm-hmm. I think Councilmember Kloba said there had been a recent meeting of the what is the group, the State Retirement Committee of some kind?
And, of course, my computer has quit for the evening now.
Well, it wouldn't have been in a budget because that's a statutorily constituted
Yeah, I think
thing.
You're right.
No, it was a – there was a hearing yesterday, and there's one tomorrow.
It's like a joint committee on pension policy?
I think that sounds as close to
it. Yeah, that sounds like it.
Yet.
Yeah.
Mr. Asher is our chair. Are you willing to take
sure.
that?
Sure. We'll take a look at it.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what the two systems may be very similar from the beginning. Yeah, I'd like to know the issues if you
Well, the key difference is that the Left One system has a lot of surplus in it, and the teacher system is currently underfunded. Right. We're talking about combining to try to balance that out. But, of course, the police and firefighters are very concerned about, well, that's going to eliminate their surplus, and all of a sudden their retirement system isn't stable anymore. So that's the issue that was raised.
So the committee.
Okay.
Yeah.
The committees that are working on it right now is a Select Committee on Pension Policy, which
one.
Met this morning in Olympia, and then the Left Two board meeting is tomorrow, and they will...
But we're only talking Left One is
right.
the concern. Right.
Well, but Left Two is talking about a Left One and Left Two merger study. So,
yeah.
So what? And I think that the idea behind that is that it would preserve money that came from those particular employee
Preferred.
Groups
yes.
into the same employee groups,
yes.
and which seems to be one of the crux issues. But I'll send you this email.
All right. If nothing else, Laurie can get the position information from the Firefighters
yeah.
State Firefighters Association. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. We can take a look at it for sure.
The second thing I want to mention is something that comes up before our next meeting, which is that National Walk to School Week is October 3rd to the 7th, I believe. And I don't think we've yet seen any kind of a schedule as terms of when schools are doing programs related to that. And so I just wanted to ask if the staff could research that for us and let us know what the opportunities will be for council members to participate.
And then if they could let us know which people are signed up to go where so that we can fill in the holes if we need to.
Yep.
Thank you.
Got it. We'll do. That's it.
Okay. That's all you have? Mm-hmm. Great. Well, I think we did an awful lot of work. I'm so glad Mr. Asher's back and well-rested.
Him too.
And well-read.
Well-read? Thank you very much. Good night. We're adjourned. Night.